Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt
Allen. And welcome back to UFC Fight Night, Font versus Aldo. As always, one half your host, new Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CraigAllenFNP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen, FNP, on the respective socials. Matt, we've been away for a couple of weeks. Yeah. I mean, it seems like it was so long ago that we had UFC Vieira versus Tate, but yes. And now, coming up this weekend, 14 fights on the docket, 6 ranked fighters in total. It's a 3.5 out of 5-star over on Fight Matrix, Matt. This is a fight night card that the people can get excited about, and I know there's a lot of fights on this undercard that you and I are really looking forward to.
This is a good fight night card. It's not one that's going to blow your socks off. Like, remember back in the Fox era, there was all the fight night cards, but there was like 3 or 4 times a year there was that big Fox card that would almost rival like a pay-per-view. I would say this is closer to one of those big Fox cards than some of the most recent main cards, or at least fight nights that we've had lately. I mean, let's be honest, Misha Tate, Caitlin Vieira, that's a good fight, but that's not one of those main events that you're going to be talking about for the weeks and days after the fight. Rob Font versus Jose Aldo is one of those fights, though. That's going to be 5 rounds of absolute insanity, and I cannot wait for a lot of other great fights on this card, too.
Should be an amazing fight. Let's throw it on over to our Fight of the Night screen. As always, brought to you by Manscaped. Check them out. Use the promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping on your order. We're getting close to the holidays. I'm excited about it. So check them out. Let's go over to the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
And how could we not go with the co-main event? Matt Broderdell's taking on Rafael Fiziev. There's so many things that I could say about this fight. Former striking coaches over Tiger Muay Thai. Listen, the Hickman brothers have left recently. Bang Tao Muay Thai is a real thing that exists now. So good luck over there to those guys. But they've been training a lot and getting fighters ready over in the States. Brad Riddell, an interesting case at City Kickboxing. And for Fiziev, no longer really a Tiger Muay Thai. I mean, again, striking coach, but he's been at Sanford for some time throughout the pandemic. There's so many different intricacies and layers to this fight, but I absolutely love it. And as soon as I saw it, a lot of people reached out and knew how excited I was going to be about this one.
The matchmakers just knew what they were doing on this. And I feel like after both guys finally got into the UFC, we've just kind of been waiting for this fight to finally happen. So it's been really nice to see both guys just have sustained success to where it's actually reasonable putting them in there together. And this is sort of, oddly enough, one of those weird like prospect versus prospect, even though they're both a little bit more advanced in their careers, because the winner of this fight, it might not be a main event next, but you get the idea. It's going to be nothing but main cards and main event type slots from here on out. And the loser should be able to recollect themselves. That's how good of a fight this is, though. I don't know how this fight can't deliver.
Sometimes co-main events on fight nights are Andre Arlovsky, Carlos Felipe, and sometimes Yikes. They're Brad Riddell and Rafael Fiziev. And for our second choice out, listen, these are the new look thumbnails that you're going to see out there for the individual videos. Had the individuals changed? No, they have not, but those thumbnails have. And listen, Manel Kopp's going to be taking on Zhalgash Zhumagulov, and this is one of those ones where I get myself psyched up for it, but you should too, because for Manel Kopp, former Ryzen champ, came into the UFC and kind of sputtered a little bit. He wasn't as active as he used to be. Maybe it was the absence of the wrestling shoes. Maybe it was the absence of the ring. And I saw even last night before we're taping this, Ryzen had an event in a cage. So that was pretty cool to see. But for Manel Kopp, found his form his last time out against Ode Osborne. Missed weight at 129, but that's neither here nor there. Going to be taking on Kazakhstan's Zhumagulov, who's been training for the last year out of American Top Team. Bit of a different look for our land's own Zhumagulov. I really do like this fight. It should be fireworks at 125.
It feels like we're finally going to know how good Manel Kopp is after this fight, because there have been so many weird performances and just weird circumstances surrounding all of his fights so far in the UFC, to where you know he's a really promising talent. You just don't know how promising that talent will be. But I do feel like if he can beat Zhumagulov, it's like, okay, you are going to at least be fighting those 10 to 15 guys from here on out. Let's say he goes out there, beats him impressively and there's no issue on the scales, then we might even be talking about him fighting, you know, I know they already fought Mateusz Nicolau, but the Nicolaus and those type of people from here on out. And for Zhumagulov, this is a massive opportunity, because if you are one of those non-UFC MMA watchers, and if you haven't been following Manel Kopp throughout his whole MMA career, you know just how good he is. So a win over Kopp is a huge deal for Zhumagulov.
Big time opportunity for both of these guys, and an opportunity for you as well to check out Manscaped, all the great products over there. Use promo code FNP. You're going to get 20% off and free shipping. Those fight of the nights, there are plenty of them, and a big time card coming up this weekend. Listen, if you didn't get enough of it, there's the 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner. There's the great body wash as well over at Manscaped. But listen, we're not here to talk about Manscaped the entire time. We have a full slate of fights, 14 of them from top to bottom. Smolka taking on Morales, Knight and Menafield, a couple of evenly matched light heavyweights, and all the way up through, there's a lot of great ones. Our hardcore's favorite being Clay Guida taking on Leonardo Santos. But Matt, I really am excited about this fight card. If there's one fight that's definitely flying under the radar on this one before we really get going, which one would you pick here?
It's a toss-up between two. I guess I'm going to go with Jimmy Crute and Jamahal Hill, because there was a time where both guys were viewed as kind of the next big thing in the division. And yeah, Jamahal Hill had that weird fight against Paul Craig where he broke his arm. Luckily, he has been able to recover, and he seems to be 100% now. And for Crute, it's been weird. He'll look like a world beater one time out, and then you'll have some question marks about his performance the next time. So I think this is a really important fight. And it's a great fight, too, because how often is it where, okay, there's a fight night card, the main event might be two ranked fighters, but then there's no other fighters in the rankings the whole way throughout. Crute and Hill are two of the top fighters in their division, so I think it's going to deliver and be an exciting fight as well.
Crute, Hill, Fazeev, Riddell, and Font Aldo, your six ranked fighters. I can't wait for this card. Make sure you let us know down below who you're taking in these fights. And the one that I'm really looking forward to, just throwing it out there, Jake Matthews, Jeremiah Wells. Really well matched. You're not going to want to miss any of that. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Couple of dueling bantamweights looking to lock horns coming up this weekend, and a couple of guys with some real meta nicknames. We have The Last Samurai, Lewis Smolka, taking on Vendetta, Vince Morales. And I have to say this, lay my cards on the table. I've been wrong about both of these guys before, and for Lewis Smolka, we have a little bit of a saying here at Fight Night Picks, or I should say, that's where the record scratch comes in. We used to have a saying about Lewis Smolka. Matt, let's throw it on over to a clip.
Go for the takedown. I'm going to do a front flip and then try to get on your back. And the worst case, I'll go for a triangle. Lewis Smolka is very happy to be on his back during the fight. And I think Casey Kennedy's going to be able to exploit that.
Always used to say the Lewis Smolka effect. And it was in so many videos. There were so many examples because, Matt, you talked about it in that clip. But he used to get so happy to be on the bottom, to work his jiu-jitsu, where you're going to get caught. And you said it before the Casey Kenney fight. He's going to get caught in one of these positions. And what happens? You get caught in a one-arm guillotine. You get submitted. So then in his next fight, we're all flying high and mighty. He's fighting Jose Alberto Quinones, a guy who was a bit of a jobber in the UFC. He could box. He could throw hands. He could wrestle a little bit. But at the end of the day, struggled against some of the better fighters. First exchange in that fight, this is where we were wrong. Quinones runs in, gets the takedown. Smolka goes full Angus Young on the stage, but on the side of the cage, and he's on the bottom, uses feet to push off the cage and gets back up to his feet. And the Lewis Smolka effect is no more. Second round, another takedown from Quinones. Smolka gets right back up. He ends up throwing great leather. Very good hands. Nice 1-2 down the pipe. Big time win for Smolka too. And the craziest thing about this guy, made his UFC debut in 2014. Main evented very shortly thereafter against Paddy Houlihan. Ended up going on a skid against some of the better fighters in the promotion. He was a giant favorite when he fought Brandon Moreno years ago. So he takes his talents outside of the UFC. He wins four fights impressively on the regional scene. Comes back in. And since he's been back with the UFC, all five fights have ended in finish. Now, he's 3-2 in those, but regardless, he has been finished by Matt Schnell, submission, and Casey Kenney. But Matt, Lewis Smolka, the most exciting guy at bantamweight?
He has that kill or be killed mindset. And he is one of those fighters where no matter what his record is, you're probably going to like him more than you should, you know? Because that is his style. He's like Jimmy Manoa. You're going to win by stoppage or you're going to lose by stoppage. But it's not going to be boring. And that's what MMA fans care about at the end of the day. The weird thing about Smolka is that He has really good skills when you think about all of his, like, A-quality skills. They just don't really complement each other all that well. Like, he has good wrestling, but he doesn't have great wrestling. And his two best positions are, he's a really good puncher in tight, even though he's got long, wiry arms. See? There's some contrast there. And he's a great fighter when he's got that top position. He is sort of that leather blanket type of a fighter. Lead blanket, not leather blanket. He's got that lead blanket type of a style. But it is very odd because he can get held down. It's almost like he's so heavy on the mat that he does have a hard time getting back up. Now, it will be interesting when we do see him start to fight those upper echelon grapplers again, because someone like Casey Kenney, who can use his defensive wrestling to almost force you to become a sloppy striker yourself, and then he can go for his own takedowns, that's one thing. Out-grappling Jose Quiñones isn't that big of a deal. Like, he's like, remember Paul London in the WWE?
Yeah.
Weird reference, but like, he's kind of like him. Like, he was around, he'd do cool stuff, but at the end, you knew he was probably going to lose in that three count. Weird reference. It's going to be really interesting in this fight with Vince Morales, because I was in the same boat as you. I did not have a very high opinion of him going into that Draco Rodriguez fight, and I really thought Rodriguez was going to be able to out-wrestle him, out-strike him, just kind of out MMA him, because nothing Morales did in my mind was going to be able to go out there and overpower Draco Rodriguez. That fight wasn't even close.
No, that's the craziest part about it. For Vince Morales, he's a guy out of the Pacific Northwest. His cousin's Ricky Simone, who cornered him in his last fight. But so did John Wood, and that's the other thing. Vince Morales moved full-time for his last camp down to Syndicate, so he's been full-time in Vegas, still there getting ready for this fight as well. You talk about a litany of training partners there. They are aplenty, but for me, I mean, I look at it, Frank Hickman in some of the pictures, which was a little bit of a surprise. Cameron Else, there's all sorts of great guys there. Else maybe notwithstanding, but when I looked at Vince Morales, he's a guy that can do a lot of things very well. It's just maybe piecing them together has been an issue. And when you're fighting fighters like a Chris Gutierrez, sometimes you're going to lose by TKO due to leg kicks. Andre Ewell's a pretty good fighter. Did he lose by TKO due to leg kicks?
Pretty much.
Well, yeah, the leg kicks made a giant difference. So for Morales in that fight against Rodriguez, he did very, very well. Now, for Morales, I look at him as a guy that can really push the action. And with Smolka, my one issue is, now he had a wild first round against Quiñones. Second round, he ends up getting the finish. Quiñones' cardio dropped off a cliff at the end of the first round. Smolka's not a giant volume guy. He's also a guy that leads heavy on his lead leg. Like, you watch a Nate Diaz fight where he boxes, but he keeps a lot of pressure on his front leg. Smolka will fight in that type of a stance, and he can really get chopped down. So I'd be looking to Morales in some of those exchanges for his leg kicks. But I look at this fight, Team Oyama for Smolka. He's been there forever. Morales out of Syndicate. Now you're coming into this fight where, again, Smolka was actually booked in a giant fight this past summer, fell out due to staph infection. That was supposed to be against Sean O'Malley. Now he draws Vince Morales here. So again, these guys, very well matched. The one other thing I want to say about Smolka, weighed 134.5 for his last fight against Quiñones, but that was the rebooking of the fight because he weighed in at 139 before that for a fight against Quiñones, and unfortunately there were a lot of complications due to the weight cut. I still worry about that for him in this one because this is a guy that had trouble at 125 as well.
And that's the thing. When you have problems at 125, that's one thing. When you move up in weight, we all kind of expect those problems to just be alleviated. Like, no, okay, Johnny Hendricks, not a great example. John Lineker, okay, another bad example. But for the most part, when guys move up in weight, they no longer miss weight. So I do share those same concerns. But what I will say about Smolka is that he's at the lower end of MMA fighters where he does have a very easily distinguishable skill set. Like, he's not just a wrestle boxer. He's not just a jiu-jitsu player. Like, he does have a unique skill set. And that's the one thing that I always have a hard time picking against when we're talking about unranked fighters where there are some unknowns about them. Because with Vince Morales, I like your point about how Smolka doesn't fight with a very high output. But the counter to that is he does move forward a lot. So if he can at least get into some clinch exchanges to where he might not be the one throwing a lot of punches, but at least he's putting out some of the fire of Morales, I do think he might be able to even some of those striking totals as the fight goes on if it does go late. And for Smolka, if he gets that top position one time in this fight, I really do think he can do enough damage to at least change the momentum of this fight. Now, does that mean he's going to get mount, drop elbows, take the back, and get the finish immediately? No, not by any means. But Smolka has one of those games where he's got really deceiving ground and pound, and that's the thing about him. He is tall and thin, but he's got decent power in his shots. So If he gets that one spot, I think the fight could be over. Whereas for Morales, he's just going to have to be really consistent throughout 15 minutes. And that's hard to do against a guy like Smolka, who's been in there with some of the best guys in the division. And the last thing I'll say about Smolka is that he kind of reminds me of Jamie Mullarky. Like, Jamie Mullarky's lost to some really good fighters, and then he goes and trains with them. Like, he's trained with Volkanovski, he's trained with Brad Riddell after he's lost to them. Luis Smolka has trained with Brandon Moreno after they fought. Like, they were like, hey, just because we fought doesn't mean we have to hate each other. We can learn from each other. So the thing I like about Smolka is that when he does lose, he doesn't normally come back and it's the exact same fighter. He will add something to his game.
It's really interesting, too, because for Morales, you can look at some of his wins. I mean, the Amon Zahabi fight, I thought Zahabi won that fight, but it was very close. And then his fight against Benito Lopez, that one could have gone either way. It was a very, very close fight. Not all fights that end by unanimous decision are blow-away victories. I mean, some of them can be very close. He beats Draco Rodriguez, loses the first round, comes back in a big way in rounds two and round three. He's a guy that even if you look at his losses, it's the 2-1-2. It's like the Azealia Banks song. He's got two by decision, one by knockout, two by submission. And again, as I said, for Smolka, it's either kill or be killed, or so it has been in the recent string of wins. We look at the odds for this one. Smolka opened the favorite at a minus 185. He's now roughly a minus 141 over on Best Fight Odds. For Vince Morales, opened at a plus 160. He's a plus 115 or thereabouts. We look at the Tapology votes. I expect them to be far and away for your favorite. I'm going to set it, Matt, over under 75% Smolka. What are you thinking?
I was thinking 70, so I'll say slightly under. Wow,
1,210 total votes, 87% Smolka, 70% by decision. You got 13% by submission, 9% by knockout. For the 13% that are Morales, 66% have him to win by decision. Matt, I feel like you tipped your hand a little bit, but who are you picking in this fight?
When you've got one guy who either wins by finish or loses by finish, fighting a guy who doesn't often win by finish, it does make my decision a little bit easier. Because if this fight is ended before the 15 minutes are over, it's because Luis Smolka has probably won the fight. I doubt Morales has the ability to go out there and submit him, and I don't think he has the power to TKO him on the feet either. Because I do think Smolka, if things get bad, he's almost got that Damian Maia effect, where if you drop him and if you're not 100% sure he's hurt, you're not just going to jump in and try to finish him afterwards. You are going to be somewhat hesitant to just go for the finish. So I actually do like Smolka in this fight.
It is a really, really tricky one. Again, for Morales, you got to try and implement some of those kicks. You got to try and bring in a little bit of your volume. For Smolka, he has been out for almost a full year. For Morales, his last time out only 3 months ago. I absolutely love the camp change out of Morales, and I think if he's able to bring in some of that top pressure with his wrestling, which is way easier said than done against a very slick jiu-jitsu player in Smolka, but I do like Morales in this fight. So I've got Morales. I think he's going to get it done by decision. You've got Luis Smolka to continue his reign of terror and try and make it two in a row for Team Oyama's Own. We're split on the pick. I've got Morales. You've got Smolka. Big time fight coming up this weekend. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Alex Morono's career has been a little bit like Seymour Skinner's back.
Mother always said a curvy spine is the devil's roller coaster.
Because if you look at it, it's absolutely insane. He's taking on a guy with an equally impressive, or should I say weird, run in mixed martial arts. I'm talking about, hey, Mickey. It's Mickey Gall, and for Mickey Gall, he's a guy that comes into the UFC, he's what, 1-0, he debuts in 2015, gets a win, it's on looking for a fight, he ends up in the UFC, you're fighting the Sage Northcutts, the CM Punks, and then the George Sullivans of the world.
Don't forget about Mike Jackson, Craig.
And Mike Jackson. So for Gall, it's been such a weird, wild, rocky ride. You look at his losses, I mean, Diego Sanchez, Mike Perry, you know, the guy that won in bare knuckle, but barely, by split decision. And then he goes out and fights Jordan Williams last time out. He's a decent-sized underdog in the same realm as he will be coming up this weekend. And it's a totally new Mickey Gall. And that's where I have to really stop, hold the phone. Let's talk a little bit about Gall. Because this is a guy that had a great jiu-jitsu pedigree. Very big for the division. He's one of the bigger fighters you're going to find at 170. Almost like a Michael Chiesa type of frame on him. And for Gall, he was always known as a guy that's going to try and wrap you up, take you down, and submit you. His last fight, he comes out. And the other thing I should say, he's always been a guy to cross train. He was always out of New Jersey. But then he started to filter in. He started to move west. He went to California. He worked out with Joe Schilling. He had those kickboxing influences. And then you'd watch his fights and you'd go, well, Okay, but where is this paying dividends? Because striking defense isn't there. Striking offense isn't there. All you have is your grappling abilities. But Gall in his last fight, if you can believe it, had Matt Brown, who's supposed to be on this card, taking on Brian Barberena, but COVID forced Brown out. He had Matt Brown in his corner and trained with the Immortal extensively for that fight. First little bit of an exchange that Gall throws, short right hook in tight, he drops Jordan Williams. Now, Jordan Williams doesn't have the greatest chin. We've seen this. Nasruddin Imavov definitely checked it. But Jordan Williams knocked out Gregory Rodriguez, so he has to be good at something, right? So when I look at Gall, his striking was great in his last fight. He was able to tee off a couple of different times because you're always worried about keeping your hands a little bit lower for the threat of the takedown. He drops Jordan Williams. He ends up getting on his back. He gets the rear naked finish as Williams is trying to get back up to his feet. Awesome win for Mickey Gall. I don't know whose Cheerios Mickey Gall pissed in to get Alex Morono, but when we're talking about a guy who has that Seymour Skinner background, Alex Morono, second degree black belt in jiu-jitsu, black belt in taekwondo, trains at Gracie Baja Woodlands, but also Fortis MMA, has Saif Saud in his corner, but also cornered Ricky Tercios when he won the Ultimate Fighter, the latest season. Matt, I've said a lot about Mickey Gall. I've said a little bit about Alex Morono. The reason why I throw in the Devil's Roller Coaster is because this guy is 9-4 with one no contest in his UFC run. He's won bonuses. He's had Fight of the Nights. He's had performance of the
Nights. Why are you yelling at me?
But the 5-1-in for Alex Morono, and this is why it really comes wooden roller coaster on the beach full circle.
Chaos Williams, the scariest man in the division.
Fights Chaos Williams, didn't look good, got knocked out quickly. Fights Reese McKee, looks amazing. Fights Anthony Pettis, looks bad. Beats Cowboy Cerrone, beat him bad. Won a performance bonus for that. And then went out and had a very competitive and overwhelming fight over David Zavada where he wins. Listen, the judges scored it 3x30-27. Big win for Morono. But when I look at this fight, Matt, like what did Mickey Gall do to get this?
Okay, I agree with everything you said. But let's not act like beating the corpse of Cowboy Cerrone is that big of a deal anymore, okay? Like, that hasn't been important to me since the early half of 2017. And I love Cowboy Cerrone. This is the thing. If anyone tells you they know what version of Mickey Gall is going to show up on Saturday, tell them to get out of town and then out of the next one and the next one. Because there's just so many question marks around him. You got to remember, the UFC around like UFC 200, it was a very strange time. Strict drug testing had just been implemented about 10 months previously. They were about to get sold to a massive billion-dollar company, and they were trying to figure out how do we either build prospects, build stars, or figure out who's going to kind of lead us into this next generation. So they were kind of experimenting. They were doing the Contender Series stuff. They were building the Contender Series stuff. They were doing the Dana White looking for a fight and whatnot, which is what produced Mickey Gall and Sage Northcutt. But that's where the whole CM Punk thing came into play. And that was a really weird time because anybody who fought a professional wrestler in their MMA career, it's a really hard thing to then try to break that down and add that into the equation. So he just had a really weird bring up through the sport. And even the Sage Northcutt win, like, I probably think higher of Sage Northcutt than I should. And I still don't think that win means anything to me. Like with Sage, he left the UFC, which was weird because I felt like he was just starting to find his footing. He gets fed to a monster in one championship, and we haven't seen him since because he was injured so badly in that fight. So with Gall, I would say his best win is Jordan Williams, without a doubt. Like, that, no one's going to argue, I don't think.
The Salim Tuahari fight, if you want to go back and watch it, don't. It's awful.
And George Sullivan wasn't really a UFC caliber guy either. I know he had a few stints or he had a few fights in the UFC, but he was never really a top tier guy either. So I still look at Gall as basically just a jiu-jitsu guy who throws really heavy on the feet. Because that's what I do think Gall's kind of resorted to. He's figured out, okay, my wrestling might not be top, top tier, although my jiu-jitsu is. If I just throw really, really hard, it's either going to force my opponent to shoot bad takedowns on me, which is going to open up defensive submissions, open up scrambles, which of course Mickey Gall's going to be able to out-scramble most guys in this division. But I do worry about him when he does fight any guy in the feet who has A, good wrestling defense, and B, a good level of output. Because Diego Sanchez didn't beat him by just hitting him with a big shot and putting him down. He beat him by putting a pace on Gall that Gall just couldn't keep up with. And that's the thing I always go back to. It's funny that you bring it up right to start this video. You say, okay, Gall's one of the biggest welterweights in the division, which he is. But there was this whole conversation before the Sanchez fight of, hey, I might move down to lightweight. Like, think how big I'd be at lightweight if you think I'm big at welterweight. It's a really weird thing to say when in your next performance you have difficulty cutting the weight and then your cardio looks really bad against Sanchez. And then same thing against Mike Perry. Perry is known for being a big brawler on the feet. Mike Perry looked like Canelo Alvarez against Mickey Gall. He's popping the jab. He's striking at range. He's defending takedowns.
Looked like a guy that would eventually fight Michael Seals in a triangle.
Exactly. Like, he had a bright future ahead of him, and you knew that based off that performance. But the things I worry about is that, okay, Gall is a good grappler when he has top position, but Mike Perry was able to hold him down and stay in his full guard and not really be that worried about any submissions off the back of Gall. So
this,
in this matchup,
this is a guy who was cornered by his girlfriend and walked out to Beyonce's Halo for that fight.
Yeah, and he was still able to beat the brakes off Mickey Gall. So when I think about this matchup, does Alex Bruno hit as hard as Mike Perry? Not at all. But are their games kind of similar after that? Well, yeah, a little bit. Like, Morono can strike from the outside. He can use volume, things that have worked against Mickey Gall in the past. He's got good wrestling defense. He's got great jiu-jitsu of his own, so I don't think it's a case of, oh, if Gall gets him down one time, it's over. I just don't really know where Gall has any massive strengths when you base him against Alex Morono, because the thing about Morono, you kind of have to be a specialist to beat him. You need absurd punching power. You need absurd striking speed. You kind of need to be special in one aspect of your game to get a win over him. And I don't know if Gall is special in any one area.
There's one thing that Gall does very well that if he's able to do it and implement it early can cause Alex Morono giant problems. You go back to the Pettis fight. What did Pettis do? He threw a little bit of wild stuff. He threw a lot of output. He marched Alex Morono down. Morono's a guy, he can switch stances, he can throw good volume, but when he's backed up, he's not very good. And there's very few fighters that are good backing up. Mickey Gall's not a guy that's very good backing up, but Morono isn't that great. You mentioned it early. If you can fake him out with the hands a little bit, get him worried about the takedown, and then start to throw. You've seen the power out of Gall. Again, Jordan Williams doesn't have a hell of a chin. Look at his fight against Kazula Vargas years ago. But Mickey Gall definitely has gained in his boxing abilities. And if he was able to throw a little bit of a leg kick, you never know. Things could progress. He's still almost 30 at this point. 10 pro fights. But again, he came in with one. He beat Ron Templeton. That sounds like the name of a mouse in a children's book. So when I look at Templeton, and when I look at the odds for this one, Alex Morono open to -270, is -232 favorite on best fight odds. For Mickey Gall, open to +230, is +185. We haven't looked at the Tapology votes, so they are a surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to set the over-under at 70% Morono.
I think it's over.
Yeah, it's over. 1,221 total votes, 86% Morono, 64% by decision, 26% have him to win by knockout. For the 14% that have Gall, 46% have him to win by submission. I started off the video asking whose Cheerios did Mickey Gall piss in, but eventually you got to fight guys like Alex Morono. You've already fought Diego Sanchez. You beat Jordan Williams, who's fought Nassourdine Imavov, Gregory Rodriguez to get into the UFC. He fought on Contender Series 3 different times, so listen, stuff's got to happen. But for me, I like Morono with the volume. I like him with the stance switches. I think he's just more of a striker than Gall is. I definitely worry about him in some of the in-betweens. Mickey Gall is a great guy at just sinking in his submissions. I mean, I don't have to tell you that. You know that by now. But I do like Morono for the complete package. But I would still stay away from this fight, to be honest.
I don't know why I paused right there. Okay, this is the thing. I agree that Alex Morono does have trouble backing up. But the problem is, let's say both these guys have that march forward kind of a mindset. At a certain point, Mickey Gall's gas tank is going to run out a lot faster than Alex Morono's. And I'm almost certain of that. I've seen Morono throw hundreds of strikes in his MMA fights and not get tired by the third round. Now, yes, his pace and technique does get a little sloppy in the third round. But for the most part, that's only after he's thrown an insane amount of strikes. Whereas with Gall, I can trust him to stay technical and stay powerful for at least a round, but I do worry about him in that second and third round as the fight continues, and Morono's not the type of guy you want to be tired in a cage with, so no, I do agree with you. I like Alex Morono.
If you want the blueprint for Morono in this fight, go watch his fight with Max Griffin. If you want the blueprint for Mickey Gall, just watch his last fight. I mean, you can go back through, you can have some fun, you can watch the George Sullivan fight or the Salim Tuari fight, but you're probably not going to want to.
I just really don't want Mickey Gall to win this fight and then fight Chaos Williams, because I would be seriously scared for his health at that point. Like, this is what I'm thinking about. Yeah, we're getting to the point where, like, okay, if Mickey Gall wins this fight, it could be the worst thing for his career, because if you beat Alex Morono, like, then you're gonna be fighting, like, the types of guys that your new mentor should be fighting. Like, you're gonna be fighting the type of guys that they were gonna give to Matt Brown. Now they're gonna be given to Mickey Gall, and I don't know if Gall's ready for some of those matchups. Like, I don't think he's ready for guys like Tim Means. I don't think he's ready for those, like, borderline top 15 guys who can defend takedowns, who are really well-rounded. So This just odd matchmaking. Like, you did set it up in the perfect way.
Matt, both of us going with the Devil's Roller Coaster, Alex Morono to get the win. Let us know down below. You going with Team New Jersey, Team Gall, or you going with Texas' own Morono? H-Town's own. He's like, what's his name? Tim Williams.
What?
Magnolia City.
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Well, big time fight coming up this weekend that you're not going to want to miss. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Almost 3 years ago, Felipe Lins won $1 million at heavyweight with the PFL. And coming up this weekend, he was supposed to make his light heavyweight return. It was, what, 4 years in the making? He had lost to Vadim Nemkov, and he was supposed to make it down to 205 after fights fell out left, right, and center. I had a graphic I was going to throw up. He had like 5 or 6 fights that fell out. He's supposed to fight Ovince St. Preux this fall. St. Preux's out. Now he's in a giant fight against Azamat Mirzakhanov, a guy whose nickname is a professional, who was supposed to be in the UFC in 2017, but ended up getting a 2-year USADA suspension because he took, and I want to make sure I pronounce it properly, Boldenone. So Mirzakhanov, Roman Dolidze, Carlos Felipe, guys that were supposed to make their UFC debuts a little bit earlier, ended up having some USADA issues. And for Mirzakhanov, it kind of worked out because he ends up going over to Brave Combat Federation, fights in their Openweight Grand Prix, wins it at Brave CF 19, or sorry, 29. Who else was on that card? Well, Ilya Topuria was on that card. Luana Pinheiro fought Helen Harper. That was the first women's fight ever in Bahrain. I'll remember that forever. But for your man, Azamat Mirzakhanov, he wins that Openweight Grand Prix. And you might go, Cray, what's an Openweight Grand Prix? Is it kind of like Pride? Yeah, it's a little bit like Pride. So I want to make sure that I throw this out here before I go any further. Because, listen, Mirzakhanov gets his debut in the UFC off win on Contender Series. And that wasn't that long ago. It was this past season of Contender Series. He did, however, have a long layoff. So he fights in Brave. He fights, listen, Mohamed Farahdin. He fights who else? Guto Innocente, great kickboxer. And then there's a 2-year layoff or thereabouts before he fights Mateo Scheffel over on Contender Series. The weights in that Openweight Grand Prix. Okay, so Innocente weighed 113 kilos. You had, who else? Farahdin, 96.5 kilos. And then you had your guy here, Azamat, weighing in at 104.2. He's no stranger to fighting bigger guys. And the weight difference is there. Not huge in terms of guys at light heavyweight, guys at heavyweight. Nothing insane. This is the point that I want to make about this fight. Because, again, it was supposed to be Felipe Lins. It was supposed to be at 205. Azamat fights Mateo Scheffel over on Contender Series. It's the main event. What was it? Week one of Contender Series this past season. He's in that main event. He's a giant favorite in that fight. He spends 2 minutes and 50 seconds bobbing back and forth on the balls of his feet. Quick. Doing a really good job out of southpaw. And then goes bang, 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 knockout. Scheffel's completely down. The fight's over. Herb Dean did an awful job with the stoppage in that one because there was an extra shot or two there that he probably could have stopped because he was right there, but listen, sometimes that stuff's going to happen a bunch of different times. My point is, after the fight, Dana White's handing out his contracts, and what he had to say was the fact that this is a guy that could go down to 185. I think he could have success at 205, but he'd probably have a lot of success at 185 too. And he was supposed to fight Felipe Lins at 205. He's fighting Jared Vandera, who weighed 265.5 for his last fight. He's a heavyweight that cuts to make the limit. He has a giant 9-inch reach advantage. He also has a giant 6-inch height advantage in this fight.
Do you know what he doesn't have, though? He doesn't really have a solid skill advantage in any one area, and that's really what's making me hesitant about picking him, because you're right, he is so much bigger, and at a certain point, size does matter. Like, we talked about this in sports all the way growing up. Like, you had that friend Drew who played hockey, and was he better than the other kids? No. Was he 10 times bigger than the other kids? Yeah.
He had a man's body in grade 7, but eventually you can't just skate in a straight line.
Exactly. But when you're young, that size really does matter. You can use that because no one else has it. But once everybody else starts to catch up to your size and you haven't really had to develop any of your skill because you've just been big your whole life, that's when you start to really struggle. This fight is going to matter. And this fight really is the litmus test for, okay, how big is too big until skills don't matter? Because with Vandera, he's got good heavyweight cardio, I'd say. I would say that's kind of his X factor if there is one. He does have good output. He's got solid wrestling. Like, He's not bad at any area, don't get me wrong. It's just he's not a specialist by any means. And if you're not a specialist just going out there expecting to win based on your volume and your overall technique, that's when smaller guys can beat you. Because let's say he does get taken down early in this fight. Your size doesn't matter if you're on your back at all, and it's actually going to make your time getting up to your feet that much harder. Now, the flip side will be, if Bandera can make this the most boring fight in the world, and I genuinely mean the most boring fight in the world, get that, like, over, under, like, 50-50 position, you're the bigger guy, hold Mirzakhanov up against the cage and just try to wear him out for as long as you can. Because if you can wear down the smaller guy, at least early on, it's going to take the bite out of his shots later on in the fight. Because the way I look at this is, I think Bandera is going to get lit up on the feet quite a bit, if I'm being honest, especially at range, just because I think he's the much slower fighter in this matchup. So I do think he's going to have to decide, okay, what range am I going to be able to fight this fight on? Because I think at the outside, he's going to be eating a lot of shots. On the inside, he might at least be able to negate some of those strikes. And then with the wrestling, maybe his size will just be able to negate a lot of, or at least defend a lot of the takedown attempts. But with Bandera, I just wish he had that one skill I could point to and say, hey, if he can go out there and just try to wrestle or just try to stick behind the jab, then maybe he'd be able to pull it off. He just doesn't have any one thing I can point to.
Again, Mirzakhanov, he's supposed to be in the UFC about 4 years ago. He's going to debut against Joachim Christensen. That probably would have been the ideal fight. It ends up Christensen gets Dominic Reyes and the rest is history. So interesting stuff there. Tell your friends that on Fight Night. That's the whole point of Fight Night picks. But for Mirzakhanov, he actually trains at a Fairfield, New Jersey at K-Dojo Warrior Tribe. You might know, like, Alexander Yakovlev trains there. He was in the UFC. Like, there are some fighters that you might recognize if you pay attention to, like, you know, Fight Night undercards. But for Mirzakhanov, I look at everything. He's a master sport in hand-to-hand combat. There's a picture of him with a trophy with Roy Jones Jr. that he won, which is kind of weird that I found in my travels. But when I really look at it, 8 first-round finishes, what else? I mean, he's got a really good double leg, and when he gets on top, that's when he does his best work. I mean, if you look at the way that Jared Vandera lost Alexander Romanov, Mirzakhanov is no Romanov. But the fights can end in similar ways, and you can definitely see a path that Mirzakhanov gets it done that way. Or Vandera does what he did to a good kickboxer in Taffa, and he just closes the distance, lands his own shots, makes it a boring fight.
Is Taffa a good kickboxer? There, I said it.
We were promised that, but that would be the way that you're going to see a Vandera win. I struggle with a guy that the boss thinks should fight at 185 to take a fight on short notice at 265. And again, let's face
it. Can I say this? I think 185 might be a little bit too small. He's 35 years old. Like, you can only cut so much weight. I honestly think 205 is the division.
That's the other thing. He's 35 getting a shot. It would have been different when he was 31, but now he's 35. So it's going to be really weird for him taking on Felipe Lins to Jared Vandera. Not that big of a difference, honestly. I mean, Lins is going to throw the hands. He can mix a couple of different things in, but as far as heavyweight's concerned, what was Lins good at in the PFL? It was his well-roundedness when he took everybody on. I mean, Alex Nicholson, who else? Cuddle Bear, Josh Copeland, like, again, it is very difficult. So, Matt, when we look at this fight, this was just announced in the last 24 hours. Not a lot of sites with odds, but the ones that did, as an average on best fight odds, Mirzakhanov opened a minus 350. It's minus 247 for Vandera. Opened a plus 285. He's a plus 198 right now. Don't expect a lot out of the Tapology votes, so I'm just going to scroll down and have a look at them. 78 votes. 87% Mirzakhanov, 81% by knockout. For the 13% that I have Vandera for fun, 50% by decision, 40% by knockout. Matt, again, this is one of those ones where at the end of the week, if you're just watching this video on Friday or Saturday, things might have changed. You get the relevance of the weigh-ins. We get to see what these guys actually look like in front of each other. That's why we have Fight Night Picks ? 2 hours before the prelims. But until then, as of now, on Sunday when we're taping this, I look at this fight. I'm taking Azamat Mirzakhanov because of his striking, because of his takedown attempts. I worry about the cardio a little bit at heavyweight, which might sound a little strange, but I do worry about it against a guy like Vandera that can zap your energy.
I think Mirzakhanov is going to win, and that will be my official prediction. But I'm very glad you set that up in the way that you did. This fight, more than any other in Fight Night Picks history, is going to be predicted based off the face-off at the end of the week. It really will. Like, if Vandera looks 10 times bigger, and if I'm like, okay, he's probably just going to be able to defend all the takedowns with the brute strength, then yeah, I'll probably pick Jared Bandera. But right now, I do have to pick the more talented guy, and I do think that is Mrazakhanov. So, yeah, I'm going to stick with the pick.
Bandera coming in 6 inches of height, and what is it? 9 inches of reach. Big. If you like him, you let us know if you're going with the mountain. Both of us have the professional Azamat Mrazakhanov in his UFC debut. Can't wait for this fight and the 13 others that are out there. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Is that Jean Volante in a mask?
It could be.
I could twirl you a Corbin Burns Milwaukee Brewers gem and tell you how good this fight's going to be. Or I could be up front and tell you, don't expect all that much. We have a big-time matchup at lightweight between the former Ultimate Fighter, Latin America Season 3 finalist, Claudio Poyas, taking on Chris Gritz Gritzmacher. And I don't know anybody in the UFC that has a more fitting nickname. Maybe Francis Ngannou, the Predator?
Damage Elkins.
Yeah, Damage Elkins. But Gritz Gritzmacher won his last fight on pure grits and grits alone. I mean, you look at the fight that he just had against Rafa Garcia. Loses the first round. Handily. Almost finished. And then in the second and third round, it's like he just smelled a dryer sheet. And he's just feeling happy, feeling good. And everything's normal. We're going to have a great day with that dryer sheet. Gritzmacher, a guy that trains out of New Bern. I mean, he's a North Carolina guy. He spent some time at some different gyms. But for Chris, he's just one of those guys that, listen, fight in, fight out. Fairly consistent with his approach. I mean, that's all the way from the Ultimate Fighter season 22 when he lost by finish to Artem Lobov. Yes, the greatest of all time. A guy that would fight who? Baronchak? In real boxing? Well, or was it bare knuckle? Whatever it was ridiculous. I'm tired of the boxing. But when I look at Gritzmacher, that's actually one of his major skills is his boxing, his forward pressure. His striking defense isn't all that great. But his chin is, and that's what's able to get him the wins over Lavares, over Joe Lozon in the UFC. That Lozon fight, UFC 223, that was a big-time feather in his cap. Now, when I look at the 5-on in, it's 2-3. And when I look at the losses, okay, he gets submitted by Chaz Skelly. That's fine. He gets submitted by Davi Hamosh. Well, if you're going to lose to Davi, it's probably by submission. And he gets knocked out by Alexander Hernandez a year ago. I mean, it might happen like that. That's just fine. That's where this fight's really weird, because this is a crossroads fight. If Poyas loses, the UFC's not going to cut him. He's a guy out of Peru that's still very young. Again, the craziest part about this is the fact that Poyas fights Martin Bravo, loses on the finale of Tough Latin America Season 3. He was 19 at the time. He's only 25 right now. And for Poyas, good wrestling, good striking, complete package. Now training at a Sanford MMA, really trying to pull those things together. Training with the likes of Rafael Fiziev, who's on this card. So a lot of good things for Poyas. But in his last fight, Matt, you want to talk about one of the more forgettable fights that you've ever seen in your life. Claudio Poyas, Jordan Leavitt. It wasn't much.
It really wasn't much. And that's the weird thing about Poyas. He's got a lot of promise when you think about his skill set, but he hasn't really been able to demonstrate the full potential of his game yet in the cage. And that's why this fight against Gritzmacher will be so important. Because for Gritzmacher, if you beat him, at least it means that you belong. It's not some massive achievement to beat Chris Gritzmacher, but it's a really good UFC caliber win. And when we look at these young sort of up and coming guys, those are all you need. Like, I would much rather you go out there and beat Chris Gritzmacher in a close decision fight that just blew the doors off some guy coming off Contender Series, because at least beating Gritzmacher in a long fight is going to at least tell me a lot more about your game. The thing about Gritzmacher is that he's kind of frustrating to watch, because yeah, he's good at boxing, he's got good hands, but he gets hit a lot on the feet. He's got good wrestling, but his jiu-jitsu is not great. Like, again, it's one of these games where not all of his skills really complement each other to their fullest of potentials. It is odd too, because with Gritzmacher, if he's the male Alexis Davis. I guess that's the best way to describe it. Like, if you're a really technical striker who has bad cardio and you've been known to panic wrestle when your cardio gets bad, you don't want to fight Chris Gritzmacher, and hopefully your manager knows that. If you do, though, he's great at defending takedowns, creating space after he does create those takedowns, or after he does defend those takedowns, and then making you pay for those attempts. But this will be a really interesting matchup, because in the past, Gritzmacher, at least his last matchup, he would defend the takedown and then look really good on the feet. With Poyas, it'll be interesting to see if he has really good success on the feet. He probably won't even worry about going for the takedown. And if Gritzmacher's the one who might start to at least panic wrestle or be the one looking to grapple, that's going to play into Claudio's at least more well-rounded game. And the last thing I'll say, Gutzmacher's cardio is going to be a really big factor in this fight because he can weaponize it, but it's a very steady pace. It's not like he's someone who's going to make you really feel his presence in the cage, but if you do have suspect cardio yourself, it's going to make him look like a marathon runner.
The craziest part about this too, and I can't understate it. Again, Poyas was on The Ultimate Fighter. He beat Marcelo Rojo in the semifinals of that to fight Martin Bravo. Like, he has good experience. He has good wins. The weird part about it, though, so he loses to Bravo. That's 5 years ago. And then he takes a lot of time off. He fights Felipe Silva. That's one of the biggest comeback wins you're ever going to see. Just record on a page, he wins by submission over Felipe Silva. He even gets a performance of the night bonus. He gets lit up on the feet. Silva was a really good Muay Thai striker. I mean, he still is, but he's old now. He's not in the UFC. But in that fight, Poirier's eyes swollen right up, but he still ends up getting the win. Then he takes a long time off again. He fights Marcos Mariano. And you might go, do I know that guy? Like, haven't I heard that name? Didn't the UFC guys tell me a lot about him? They did. He came into the UFC at 6-4. He left at 6-6. Okay. He was terrible. 30-25 by all three judges were the scores for that fight against Mariano. And you know what? Let's have a little bit of fun. What were the total strikes in that fight? 101-5 were the total strikes. Poyas had 10 minutes and 1 second of control time. And then in the Levitt fight, three judges scoring it, 29-28 for Poyas. Again, round one, Levitt. Round two, round three, Poyas. The big thing that I had in that fight, going into that fight, I picked Poyas. We different on the pick, but whatever, is the fact that he goes for high crotch single legs like they're going out of style, which Chris Gutzmacher actually defends very, very well. He did it with the two that Lozon went for in their fight, ends up getting the finish by forcing it on the feet. The one big difference, though, Joe Lozon actually did have success with his hands. I was going to say he didn't, but he actually did in that fight.
He just couldn't accept the damage anymore.
No, that's it. Claudio Poyas is a very competent striker, but again, I wouldn't side with him too much in this fight. So, let's have a look at the odds for this one, because Poyas opened a minus 150 favorite. He's a minus 109 or thereabouts. For Gutzmacher, open a plus 130. He's about a minus 120 favorite. Listen, we're looking at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to set the over-under at 65% Poyas. What are you saying?
I think they'll be under. Hopefully people respect Gutzmacher.
Look at that. No. 1,219 total votes. 79% Poyas. 76% by decision for the 21% that have Gutzmacher. 72% by decision. So Matt, the votes aren't even close, but the odds now favoring Gutzmacher. Who's your pick here?
This is a hard fight to predict because Claudio Poyas, okay, if you stack all of his skills together, it's probably going to come to a higher number than if you stack all of Gutzmacher's skills together. Like, he's the more skilled athlete out of the two. He's the more explosive out of the two. He's the younger guy out of the two. But stylistically, this is one of those matchups where if he starts to fade at all, like if you give Chris Gutzmacher an inch, he's going to take a mile. I can't believe I just said that about Chris Gutzmacher, but it is the truth. And how many times have we seen this where you have the young, promising prospect fighting that old fighter who has really good cardio? They end up losing the first round just to roar back in round two and three. It seems to happen every other event. So against my best judgment, I actually think I'm going to pick Chris Gutzmacher in this one.
Claudio Poyas has this fight. Sanford MMA going to train him right. Henry Hoof, Greg Jones, and the team. Yeah, I think they're going to have the right game plan in mind. And I think for a guy like Poyas, who trained for the longest time in his native Peru, I think it's such a big time move to Sanford. And for him to be active, he's a very special fighter to watch. So for me, I've got Poyas. I think he's going to be able to do some decent work on the feet as long as he doesn't get tagged in the first round. Again, like you said, round two, round three, Gutzmacher, one of the older guys at 35 that can actually weaponize his pace, got that 10-year age gap. I don't see that playing out very well for him against Poyas. I've been wrong before. Look what happened to Rafa Garcia, but for me, I've got Poyas.
I just think stylistically, again, Poyas is the more skilled fighter out of these two, but I really do think cardio is that big of a factor in this matchup to where if Gutzmacher could just not get taken down in that first round so that Poyas feels his pace throughout those first 5 minutes, I think the next 10 will be much easier for
the
him.
The pick is split. I've got Peru's Poyas to get the win. Matt has North Carolina's own. Gutzmacher, you let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this pivotal blow top 30 lightweight matchup between Claudio Poyas and Chris Gutzmacher. Big time fights on the scene, on the card, in the co-main event, ranked lightweights. You're not going to want to miss out. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Third time time is the charm for our booking. Coming up at light heavyweight, we have Atomic Alonzo Menafield taking on the Nightmare William Knight. This is a fight that was originally scheduled back in February on the 27th. Menafield out of that one. Then it was booked on March 27th and the Knights out of that one. And then ultimately we finally get the fight here coming up in December. Now since then, you look at the fights for these guys. You got William Knight in 2021 losing to Daoun Jung and looking awful in that fight. He got dominated in areas where you thought, hey, William Knight's a decent wrestler. Not against Daoun Jung, he's not. And he lost that fight handily. Then he roars back his last time out, gets a finish win over Fabio Chiron. For Alonzo Menafield, he was the hotness and the heat at 205. He was that next prospect that was supposed to break through. And then he fought Devin Clark, and it was a close enough fight. He didn't do great with his wrestling, but when there were striking exchanges, he definitely did a lion's share of the work. And then he goes out there and fights Ovince St. Preux, and he had a little bit of success, but he got kind of caught following Ovince St. Preux, got caught by one of those crazy shots that OSP can throw. So he had to kind of rebuild himself, let's say it that way. He goes out, fights Fabio Chiron, and somehow through the knockout lost to OSP, absorbed his Von Flew powers, and he Von Flew Chiron, had him up against the cage where you don't want to be with Chiron because he's great with defensive submissions. Then he gets him down, then he gets him choked up, and in his last fight, he ends up fighting Ed Herman where he looked great in that fight, and he put on an amazing pace against the guy that's always steady, Eddie. And as always there, especially even in the third round, Menafield looked like a totally different guy in that fight and had really good volume in that one too.
And you know how when you talk about future champions, you normally talk about them beating guys like Fabio Chiron, and we get really excited about those kind of wins.
They both beat Fabio.
That's what I mean. And I don't give a shit if I'm being honest. Like, Fabio Chiron's not a great UFC fighter, if we're being completely honest.
He's only had two tries.
And neither one were all that. Like, okay, if you have two tries hitting a ball off a tee, and you missed by like 9 feet both those tries, I don't care. You struck out after two strikes.
It's like hitting a medicine ball, though. So, like, it's going to be tough.
This is my thing with Alonzo Menafield and William Knight. They both seem to be on the cusp of being top 15 fighters in their division or at the light heavyweight division. But in light heavyweight, it just feels like the ranked fighters seem to be a lot further ahead than the unranked fighters. Like, every unranked light heavyweight to me honestly feels like they're on the exact same level. And then it seems to be quite the big step up once you get in the rankings. Like, with some divisions, it's okay. The top five seems to have kind of set themselves apart from the rest. With the light heavyweight division, more than any other, it really does feel like to me that the ranked fighters have somewhat separated themselves. Because guys like Volkan Oezdemir are barely in the rankings. And then you look and, I'll be honest, I think Oezdemir would beat both these guys quite comfortably just because he is much more technical. The interesting thing about this fight is that Menafield has had success against some top-level guys, but he has found ways to lose in the past. And the OSP fight really is the perfect example of it because he's moving forward, he's throwing good combinations, he's doing all those things you really like Alonzo Menafield, or at least you like from his game. But, like you had said, he just decides, oh, what if I stop cutting the cage off and just rush forward? And the one time he does decide to make that mistake, it does ultimately cost him. And that's the thing with Menafield. I don't think he has a bad chin by any means, but his striking defense is quite open. And when he does really allow his own hands to start opening up, that's when he can get caught. And that's going to be a really interesting point in this fight, because I think Menafield's got the better cardio than William Knight. I think he's the more positionally aware fighter than Knight. But I think the fact that he holds his chin extremely high in the air is a massive liability when you're fighting a guy like Knight, who is known for his massive power shots around the guard. And that really is the thing about Knight that you have to focus on. Yes, he can get taken down. Yes, he has some openings in his own game. But what is the perfect William Knight game plan? It was like my point with Joanne Calderwood the other week. Like, okay, the perfect Calderwood game plan still probably results in her winning a split decision. With William Knight, what's his perfect game plan? I'm going to do like the Tyron Woodley blitz forward and try to get you with one of those overhand shots. If he does that against Alonzo Menafield, he very well could catch him early on in the fight, just because Menafield does have that, I'll just kind of move backward with my chin up sort of striking defense. And that worries me. A matchup against Knight.
And I look at this one, I mean, for Knight, he's a guy, now listen, I'm gonna say something that I don't normally say, but I'm gonna go there. Look at his Instagram. Are we looking at any training videos? Not a one. Now,
care.
That could be by design, because you don't want to show what you're training for. You don't want to show, hey, listen, I've got the wrestling shoes on today. I'm trying to stuff all
Max
the takedown attempts.
Max Holloway just posts Call of Duty highlights.
Yeah, William Knight posts strength and conditioning videos. And I will say, that Jake Matthews is doing the same thing before he's fighting Jeremiah Wells. So it's not completely lost on me, but...
It looks like it's working, though.
That's all he's doing. And for Alonzo Menifield, you're getting to see the quality of training partners that he has at Fortis MMA, especially in some of the higher weight classes, including somebody that's also in this division that didn't win his last fight, but Kennedy Inshukwu, I mean, he's there. There are a lot of good guys in the higher weight classes there at Fortis. So when I look at this fight... Yes, this is a coin flip, and I much prefer if there's like an under 2.5 rounds type of line for this one, I'd be cool with it. Menifield open a minus 140 favorite. He's roughly a minus 171 right now. For William Knight, open a plus 110. He's at a plus 141 underdog. If we look at the Tapology votes, surprise to us as they are to you. 1,124 total votes, 66% Menifield, 63% have him to win by knockout. For the 34% that have Knight, 77% have him to win by knockout. Matt, you laid out a game plan for William Knight, but let's hear one for Alonzo Menifield because this guy is not here by accident.
No, and my prediction is going to be Alonzo Menifield, by the way, so I guess I'll set up how I think he's going to win. With Knight, it is going to be a lot of those big actions throughout the fight that's going to get him the win. Like, if he wins, it's probably going to be by finish, because I don't think he's at least consistent enough throughout 15 minutes to match the pace of a guy like Menifield. Because we can talk or at least knock a lot of the skills of Menifield, but what is he good at? Well, he does have a good clinch game. He does throw in combination. He does have decent cardio at the division. Like, he can at least keep a sustained pace throughout 15 minutes, and that's going to be a really big key throughout this fight. And the last thing I will say, I remember when Devin Clark fought Menifield, we were really focused on how Devin Clark throws the leg kick and how good his leg kicks are. Alonzo Menifield was actually really successful with his own leg kicks in that matchup, and I think they're going to be really important in this one too, because if he can chop down that lead leg of William Knight and take away some of the footwork and some of that explosion, it's going to make dealing with his power punches a lot easier for Menifield. So I guess the disclaimer will be, if Menifield can keep himself away from those two black lines, or at least keep himself from being backed up behind those two black lines, I think he'll be able to get the win. Just, he's the more consistent guy. Now, could it be one of those fights where he wins the first, like, 9 minutes quite convincingly and then eats a big shot like Miguel Baeza, Chaos Williams style, like coming out of the clinch? Yes, that could happen, but I'm still going to go with the guy who I think is going to be more consistent.
I like Menifield with kicks too, and that's the thing. I mean, for Knight, he's a guy, like, he eats them and eats them and eats them, and then he starts shaking his head no, and they don't affect him.
He doesn't have a good response to them, exactly.
You can come right out of it and knock out a guy like Charrant, and it's like, oh, everything's forgotten, what's the big difference? I mean, listen, this guy has insane power when he decides to use it, and when he's offensively wrestling and things are in his domain, he does a great job of that too. Like, these guys are very, very talented fighters. The last thing I have to say, these are some of the oldest prospects you're going to find in MMA. And, like, you'd think, oh, well, they must be heavyweights if they're prospects and they're 34 and 33 years old, respectively. No, it's light heavyweight. We're close enough. We're almost there. And you might see these guys at heavyweight one day. For me, I like Menifield, but ever so slightly. So, for me, I stay away from it. It's popping popcorn, but I do have Menifield here.
I'm going to say this. I think this is the battle of the two best nicknames on the card. I think Atomic's a pretty good nickname, and I think the Nightmare is too if your name's William Knight, so there you go.
Big time fights coming up on this card. We're both going with Alonzo Menifield. You like nicknames. Adamant taking on Quake in the all-action co-main event at lightweight that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Clash of styles between Colorado wrestling product Mallory Martin. She's taking on the black belt in Taekwondo. You know her as Cheyenne Velismus. Yes, she took back her maiden name. She is the Warrior Princess. It's not Baze, and she's got a big time fight coming up this weekend. Coming off a performance of the night bonus and a first round knockout win over Gloria DePaola, Matt, she put the doubters to rest. She loses that fight to Montserrat Conejo, who was supposed to be in this fight. See, Cheyenne's taking this one on short notice. It was supposed to be Montserrat versus Mallory Martin. Martin goes from taking on a wrestler to now taking on a striker. An interesting switch of the fight, because for Martin, this is somebody we talked about her all the time. I've got it in the graphic, Easton Training Center, but I could put Elevation. I could put, you know, well, she trains at Elevation, but she trains Team Onyx, I guess they call it. She trains with Rose Namajunas, is really what I'm trying to say, and trained to get her ready for her fight with Zhang Weili. So for Martin, she's looking to kind of learn from Diffusion. They have trained together for a very long time. And the one thing that I found very interesting when I looked into Mallory Martin's background, because again, I've seen her fight 3 times in the UFC. She's won one of them. She's lost 2 of them. But she lost in both of those to fighters who won the way you'd think they'd win. I mean, Vina Jandjidova submits her. Pollyanna Viana, what happens? Well, I said it in the prediction video. I said, okay, Martin's going to take her down, but you can't play in her guard. Takes her down, plays in her guard. Pollyanna going to submit off her back, and that's just how it's going to happen. So Martin definitely has to switch a few things up. But the one thing that I found very interesting, she won a Tiger Muay Thai scholarship and trained over at Tiger Muay Thai for a couple of years. You know, with Antonina Shevchenko and Loma Lukbonmi. I found that crazy because when I watched Mallory Martin fight, I did not know that. I did not know that.
No,
that great cardio, great takedowns, great ground and pound when she gets on top. But when she's striking, I just didn't figure that.
It's kind of like when they introduce Roy Nelson and they don't say, like, a boxer. They say he's a kung fu fighter. Excuse me? Because that is the thing about Mallory Martin. You hear about, or I guess you hear about what her striking could be, but we haven't seen it yet in the cage. And this is a really, really interesting fight because these are two fighters who I'm just going to call, they're in the Vanessa Demopoulos category, where it feels like every loss could be your last one. And the thing about Cheyenne Velasquez is that in 2 fights ago against Kinyeho, we talked about, oh, well, she's a pretty good offensive wrestler herself. She should be able to defend some of those takedown defense or some of the takedown attempts from Kinyeho and at least have some success in the feet. And what happened in that fight, Craig?
Matt, it was like when I play the UFC video game and I'm always at heavyweight and I'm always Mark Hunt. What do I do?
Leg
kicks. Well, leg kicks every time you win. It's a cheat code. It's like Francis Bouillon, NHL 07. You just cut in front of the net and then you put the puck in. Every single time it works. Montserrat did those head and arm throws, and every single time, they worked.
And that was, and remember how the end of that fight went too, when Cheyenne did not, lost that fight in a very poor way, and then flipped her off a bunch, and then said that Kinyeho said, or spit on her, and then after the fight, she was like, oh no, it didn't happen.
All's forgot.
Yeah, just be a better loser, that's all I'm gonna say. This is the thing about Cheyenne. I feel like people are getting a little bit too caught up in the hype based on her last knockout win. Because when I look at her and her overall striking, I don't think she's this crazy high-level striker. I think she just throws really, really hard. And it was almost like the Ronda Rousey thing, where Joe Rogan was saying Ronda Rousey is as good of a boxer as Floyd Mayweather and how, oh, her striking is as good as anybody. No, she just threw really hard. With Blissmas, she is a good striker, don't get me wrong. But is her footwork super high level? No. Is her output extremely high level? It's okay, but she lacks the ability to get fighters off of her if they really want to push a crazy pressure on her. So, when I look at her striking, I don't necessarily think it is crazy high level. And that's what I always go back to. With Mallory Martin, at least she can go out there and get takedowns. Now, is that always a good thing for her? No, not at all. You said it perfectly. Like, sometimes she will kind of have these lapses in concentration on the mat. And that really has cost her in the past, especially with her submission defense. So this fight is one of those fights where it could go any which way. And I know I wouldn't be surprised. And hopefully no one at home is either. Like, if Mallory Martin went out there, looked half decent on the feet and got a bunch of takedowns, I wouldn't be surprised at all. If Blissmas went out there, defended a bunch of takedowns, chopped down the lead leg of Mallory Martin and ended up winning like a 30-26 scorecard, I also wouldn't be very surprised by it.
Martin's taking on a very good level of competition. If you want to point to anything, you look at her path to the UFC, fights over with Invicta, beats Nicole DeSegni. You know her from the other things other than fighting.
Venus by far the best fighter on either one of these ladies' resume.
Beats Cynthia Arcio, but again, she has lost to Macy Barber from very early on, and her win in the UFC over Hannah Cyphers was a big one. Like, it was in a big way.
To us, maybe.
For Cheyenne Velasquez, win over Lindsay Garbat. She fought good competition. Lindsay Garbat fought Lupi Godinez in Canada. Beat Hillary Rose by decision on Contender Series, loses to Montserrat Kanyeo, and then beats Gloria De Paula. I think she is a very good striker. I also think the move full-time to Extreme Couture has really started to pay dividends, and I think it will continue to help her out, especially with the quality of wrestlers that you have there as well. So, Matt, when we look at this one, the odds, Velasquez open a -220 favorite. She's -190 right now. For Martin, she opened a +185. She's a +160. Topology vote, surprise to us, they are to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Velasquez.
I'll say over.
Look at that. 1,135 total votes, 84% Velasquez, 81% by decision. For the 16% that have Martin, 80% by decision. I like Velasquez in and out. I like her striking. I'm going back to the well of, I think she's the prospect I thought she was before the Kinyeho fight. I think she's going to win this one. But with the giant caveat that, again, this is such a clash of styles where Martin is so good at the one thing she does very, very well with her takedowns and her top pressure. how good can Vlismas be defending those traditional takedown attempts, the non-judo throws of Martin? That's going to be the deciding factor here. I like Cheyenne's ability in those exchanges, and I like her striking. That's why I'm going with her, but I throw that one up there.
I agree with everything you said, but I still don't think Vlismas is this, like, super high-level prospect. I don't. If you're a good striker, you can create separation. It's as simple as that. Montserrat Conejo is not a top-level fighter in the UFC whatsoever. She has really good judo takedowns, and she's not a good striker whatsoever. And Vlismas, who is a good striker, was not able to create separation. That's my only problem. Like, she is a natural striker, but when you think about the other women in this division who are also natural strikers, you're going to reach a limit where you need more than that. Because Vlismas can't outstrike Marina Rodriguez. She can't outstrike, like, I'm just saying, you're going to run into those types of fighters eventually with her skill set. Like, I just don't think she has one of these skill sets that, oh, if a few things go her way, then it'll translate into fighting people in the top five. I think she can have fun fights, but I do worry about her against top level fighters.
Matt, who are you going with here?
I think Vlismas will be able to get it done in this one, but again, it's always concerning when a fighter has three or four fights in the UFC all against, like, entry-level fighters. Like, at a certain point, we need to see a jump up in competition, and this goes for either lady. I guess with Martin, it is a little bit different. At least she has fought Jandy Hova, who is one of the top fighters in this division. So for Vlismas, let's say she is able to get this win. You're now 2-1 in the UFC. It's not like strawweight's the deepest division, so you would expect maybe a big name next. Maybe not a ranked fighter, but a fighter who was in the rankings at some point.
Both of us going with Cheyenne Vlismas to get the win in this fight and to take on Brianna Van Buren, or next
Felice
time
Herrig,
out.
Perhaps?
Big time fights on this card. Brendan Allen's taking on the Action Man, Chris Curtis in the main event. Rob Font, Jose Aldo, you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. This fight absolutely has the potential for the winner to take on a ranked opponent. We have Australia's own Jake Matthews. He came into the UFC as a kid, and he's still a young man. He's going to be taking on, well, 35-year-old Jeremiah Wells in his second time out for the company. Made a short notice debut against one Warley Alves and picked up a giant win. And if you want to go back and see a perfect UFC debut with a couple of things that you can refine, look at the way that Jeremiah Wells fought Warley Alves. On the first blitz of a flurry that he throws, is Warley off balance? Yeah, kinda. But does he also fall down? Yeah, he does. And from then on, it was the Jeremiah Wells show. Now, there was a couple of spots where Warley was trying to sync up a little bit of a submission attempt off his back. He's very, very good at that. I mean, hell, the guy's got a submission win over Colby Covington. If you want an example of how good Warley is. Now, does he have good days and bad days? Yeah, we all do. But does he have really big highs and really big lows in the UFC's octagon? Oh, frick yeah.
Like a few others.
And he definitely did against Jeremiah Wells. Now, that's not to take anything away from Wells, because this is a guy that, listen, if you were on the Underground Whisper Networks, the Twitters, the Reddits, people know Wells well. I mean, listen, when he came in to make his debut, Paul Felder was on the call. Does Felder know Philly guys? Do they have cheesesteak there?
Bear shit in the woods?
Yeah, they do. So, for Wells, you kind of got a little bit of the bump, but not as much as, like, a Zubair Takugov gets from Daniel Cormier. But that's neither here nor there. Wells definitely got a little bit of that rub, but it was more due to the fact that Felder could attest to how good Wells is inside of the gym, how good those sparring sessions were. Go back and watch that fight and listen to the commentary, but also listen to what Daniel Cormier has to say about Wells' striking. Because he's one of those guys that'll start throwing his hands out there and blitzing, but also keeping his chin way up in the air and overextending a little bit. And I'll throw some pictures up that just give a bit of an example. But I will say, he throws a 5 or 6 punch combo running across the cage, and a couple of them land, and Worley ducks away. And then the next couple of shots are the ones that ultimately finish him. So it worked out for Jeremiah in that fight. Definitely something that I worry about, especially moving forward. But this is a guy, just like that old Billy Talent song.
We just got done calling Cheyenne Vlismas a high-level striker.
Just hear me out. Just like that old Billy Talent song, not Billy Talent 2. The guy's got nothing to lose. He's 35 at this point. So you got to go out there and shoot your shot. Wells has a great opportunity against Jake Matthews to fight up into the rankings. Matthews has been around forever. This is a guy that fought Luke Jumo in the regional scene. This is a guy that had UFC caliber fights on the regional scene as a 19-year-old. And then he comes in. He's had a good run since. He's 10-5 with the company. Won a few bonuses. Had a good fight against Li Jingliang. That won a fight of the night. What else? He's had a few fight of the nights. But again, I can't highlight this enough. Wells has championship experience that's not that old in terms of his overall career. CS welterweight champ, CFFC welterweight champ. Jake Matthews, again, fought the higher level competition. Lost his last fight to Sean Brady, third round submission loss.
I gotta get really upset about that fight, though. Because here's the thing. I had a lot of people come at me last week saying, hey, Sean Brady's gonna outstrike Michael Chiesa. He's really good on the feet. I don't know if you remember, Craig, I made a pretty big point to say that Jake Matthews lit him up like a Christmas tree in their fight, and I expected Michael Chiesa to do the same. Guess what Michael Chiesa did to Sean Brady on the feet? Lit him up like a Christmas tree. Now, the prediction was still good, Sean Brady beat him, but still, Jake Matthews is a weird fighter because we always talk about how good his grappling is, and he is a natural grappler. We know how good his wrestling is, how physically strong he is, how good he is at setting up his submissions, but I feel like his striking is somewhat underrated. Like, he can put a pretty good pace on guys. He doesn't have great punching power, which is weird because you look at him, and he is built. Like, he's a big guy.
He's strictly just about doing strength and conditioning over on Instagram. Jake Matthews.
But similar to, like, Kai Kamaka, the build doesn't always translate to finishes. Like, he hits really hard, it looks like. It doesn't always have that kind of effect on his opponent. But with Matthews, he's almost the best example of, like, I don't want to just limit him to a wrestle boxer, because he does have much more of a jiu-jitsu component to his game, but he's similar to Frankie Edgar, to where he's a good striker, he's a good grappler, but he needs both to be at his best, and that's why this fight's going to be so much fun, because both guys come from that very similar camp of, we do need our wrestling to really open up with our striking. The thing I will say, though, the way Wells does throw looping overhand strikes in the feet, or just wild shots, I should say, is going to be beneficial to him in this fight to a point, because Matthews isn't the type of guy who shells up and then responds with his own counter shots. He will just kind of take the brunt of the force and then just sort of reset and either go for his own takedown attempt or just kind of reset the fight, take a step out, L step, and then we'll re-engage. I do think it's going to be a big liability for Wells, though. If he does find himself charging in, I think that's when Matthews can time a takedown attempt every single time. Like, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I don't look at Wells' sloppiness on the feet as a risk for him getting knocked out, at least in this fight, but I do see that being Matthews' entry for a lot of his takedowns. And with Matthews, he's got weird cardio. Like, if you can make him a striker, he will get tired as the fight goes on. But if he gets that top pressure, if he does just make you work from the bottom, then he can fight a very consistent 15 minutes. And it's going to be a really interesting fight for Wells, because I think Wells is going to be the better fighter on the feet, or at least the more comfortable fighter on the feet, because he does throw with such reckless abandon. But Matthews is just such a consistent guy against most non-top level fighters in this division.
Well, that's a weird thing. Both guys, very, very similar skill sets. Wells is the type of guy, explosion, athleticism, all of those buzzwords that you hate to use, but that's what the commentary uses, and then you watch his fight, and they just keep playing around. You try not to write them in your notes. But the one thing that I worry about, Wells isn't the biggest guy at 170. Yeah, from that picture, he is a big guy, but he's only 5'9". Like, he's one of the smaller guys that you're going to find at 170. Jake Matthews is a big guy at
welterweight. He fought at lightweight, though, which is crazy.
Which is also crazy. When I look at this, though, good jiu-jitsu from Wells. Good wrestling. He has great takedowns. Again, everything with tons and tons of power. Not a lot of tread on the tires either. That's a nice thing, especially for a guy that's 35. I mean, this is second fight in the UFC. He's 35. Azamat Mirzakhanov, that's also on the undercard, 35, making his debut. So, listen, the things have to align. You get fights with guys like Jared Vander at heavyweight or Jake Matthews at welterweight, and you can really move along. The odds for this one, Matthews open a favorite around, what, a minus 150? He's minus 193 on best fight odds. For Jeremiah Wells, open a plus 130, plus 159 right now. Topology votes, 1,209 of them. 74% Matthews, 82% by decision. For the 26% that have Wells, 67% have him to win by knockout. For Jeremiah Wells, 7 of his 9 wins are by finish. You love to see it that way. And actually, I was going to say, I made a little bit of a mistake. 7 or 9 of them are by finish because they're by knockout. And then one of them's by submission.
Yeah, here.
Fun
this,
stuff.
This should be a really fun fight. But I don't think Jeremiah Wells is anything better than Jake Matthews. And their games are very similar. It's like an eclipse. Like, the sun is bigger than the moon. But just by the way you're looking at it, it isn't. Jake Matthews is just kind of better than Jeremiah Wells at everything. Yes, their games look similar to a certain point, but I think Matthews is the much more controlling fighter when he gets the top position. I think he can damage his opponent much more when he gets that top position. And the thing about Matthews, I know I'm going to bring this up with Brennan Allen later, is he doesn't waste a lot of time in that top position. He's not somebody like, I know we always go back to Jake Shields for this point, but he's not somebody who will just wait and wait and wait and just kind of let it be up to the ref as to if we're grappling or if we're striking. He likes to ground and pound. He likes to go for submission. So I do expect Jake Matthews to at least control a lot more of this fight. But I agree with the Tapology break. Down. If Jake Matthews wins, it most likely will be by decision, and a very dominant one at that. And if Wells wins, it will be because of one of those like crazy looping shots.
For Matthews too, was lost in the UFC, won by split decision to Andrew Holbrook, but also submissions to Sean Brady, Anthony Rocco Martin, Kevin Lee, and James Vick. James Vick, a retired fighter. How crazy is that? Got too close to the sun. Yikes, Matt. I'm going with Matthews as well. But this is a really tight fight. This is one of those ones you guys slept on Jeremiah Wells again, and I cleaned up. Somebody will say in the comments section below. You let us know down below who you have in this marquee fight at 170, because I can guarantee you the winner of this fight, their next opponent's going to be like a Muslim Salikov type. So look out for that. I love the fight. Or Elize Uzaleski dos Santos. That'd be great too. Should be good. Should be great. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at Flyweight. We have a couple of my guys. This is a Fight Night Pick special. Flyweight never die. Mother effing Starboy Manel Kopp taking on no nickname from Kazakhstan. It's Zhalgash Zhumagulov. And this fight has so many different layers. It's like a tiramisu. And you know Khabib Nurmagomedov likes that. So if he likes it and I like this fight, I mean, what does that say?
It must be good.
It must be good. Manel Kopp, your former champ, over with Ryzen. There was so much promise coming into the UFC. I sold so many Wolf tickets that ended up being more like Wolf Cola. But really, when you look at it for Kopp, when he's on. And he's such a special boxer to watch. He can switch stances. He throws a great lead hook. But again, it's almost like he's ambidextrous. He's not one of those guys that has a particular attack from the orthodox or the southpaw stances. Now, there are a couple of intricacies within that, but by and large, relatively ambidextrous. And when you look at it, it just has to be a perfect storm. Now, his last fight out, you got to weigh 125 for your fight, Manel. And he knows that, and you know that, and I know that, but he weighed 129 against Ode Osborne. Wanted a performance bonus after the fight? You don't get that if you miss weight, but it was an impressive win against a UFC caliber fighter. It was a good win. You love to see it. Now, the two fights that he had kind of making his way in, a loss to Alessandro Pantoja, which is, listen, it's easier said than done to beat Pantoja. It really is. And in that fight, Kopp was just kind of on the back foot and didn't really start it up. And then in his next fight against Mateusz Nicolau, it's kind of more of the same thing. He just didn't. It's that Keith Richards riff. And then we're just waiting for the song to start, but it just keeps going. For Kopp, his last fight out, he was actually a little bit offensive, and then boom, right when he needed to, flying knee up the middle, bang, the night is young, Manel Kopp gets the party in Vegas. Now, he's been training, and we had him out of what? Overcome Academy, his last fight out. I went back and looked at the graphic. That's a gym that Michelle Pereira spent a little bit of time at in and around Vegas. For this one, the pictures on the Instagrams, it's primarily over at Extreme Couture, putting on the wrestling shoes, like he used to have in the Ryzen, I was going to say cage, but really it's a ring. Taking on a guy like Zhalgash Zhumagulov, you need those. If you've ever seen Zhalgash fight, man can wrestle, man puts on some pressure. Go watch his fight against Ali Bagatinov if you want an example of that.
You better own a cardio, or you better own a treadmill if you're going to fight Zhalgash Zhumagulov, because he does put such a pace on you, and it's an uncomfortable kind of pace, because he fights at a really weird range. It's one of those ranges where he can kind of be grappling you and striking you at the exact same time, because he throws these big looping shots, but you're almost chest-to-chest with your opponent. It is a very awkward range for him to be at, and it's very weird, because for Zhumagulov, I had very high hopes for him coming into the UFC. He sort of underperformed, but in his last fight, he gave me a little bit more hope. With Manel Kopp, I gotta be completely honest, and I guess this is where I'll open it up to a bit more of a debate. I don't look at him as the same fighter that I thought he was over in Ryzen. Like, I do think he's a little bit different, and I think he's lost a little bit of shine or confidence, whatever it is. I don't think he is the same guy he was before, and that's why I'm always hesitant when I look at Manel Kopp being a big favorite in the UFC, because, okay, he didn't look good against the two top-level guys who he fought, and yes, Pantoja's one of the top five guys in the division, and really anyone in the top five could fight for a title on any given day, so there's no shame in that whatsoever. But Kopp is the type of fighter who, where my expectations were, had him to beat Mateusz Nicolau. I thought with his combination of wrestling, with his power, and with his overall just durability and output.
And some would say he did.
And some would say he did, but still, I expect him to go out there and just blow the doors off Nicolau, because Nicolau doesn't have a great chin. He has good power, but still, there's some holes in his game for sure. And the fact that Kopp just never really had urgency in that fight was a little bit concerning, because this is a guy who was at the peak of the mountaintop. Like, he was the star of stars over in Ryzen. You're selling out these massive crowds, you're the champion, and then you're fighting in the apex in the UFC in front of like 13 people. I just think for Kopp, it's just such a big difference between fighting in Ryzen in front of tens of thousands of people with shoes on, between fighting in the apex in front of 12 people in a very small cage. I don't think we're ever going to see the Manel Kopp we saw in Ryzen. That's all I'm trying to say. And this is going to be the official fight where we know what kind of fighter Manel Kopp is.
I think you're going to see the corner turn from Kopp, having just turned 28, training at Extreme Couture, having good takedown defense that we've seen with other organizations, but also with the UFC against high-level fighters. I mean, Pantoja had a bit of a hard time with the wrestling. Mateusz Nicolau had a hard time with the wrestling.
Neither Manel Kopp, guy's wrestling.
I want to say out of the three fights, his takedown defense is 80%. Now, again, limited sample size, not a lot of takedown attempts. With Zhumagulov, it's just continuing to move forward. Now, for him, he loses to Haliem Paiva. I thought he won that fight in his debut. He loses to Amir Albazi, and he lost that fight. And then his last time out, he submits Jerome Rivera. But Jerome Rivera had fights at 145, 135, 125 in the UFC. Never won any of them. He had a rough go. So Zhumagulov's coming off a big finish win. And for Kopp, he's coming off a big win over Ode Osborne, who in his last fight had a competitive one against CJ Vergara that we did see not that long ago. So we have a look at the odds for this one. You kind of tipped it off a little bit, but Kopp opened a minus 260 favorite. He's minus 222 right now on best fight odds. For Zhumagulov, open a plus 220. He's now a plus 177. If we have a look at the Tapology Matt votes, Matt, surprised us there to you. Listen, I mean, 1,255 total votes, 78% Kopp, 31% by decision, 60% by knockout. For the 22% that have Zhumagulov, 71% by decision. I see Zhumagulov struggling with the side-to-side movement of Kopp and with the activity on the feet that I've seen in certain fights, notwithstanding the two fights they had against ranked guys.
My prediction is going to be Kopp, but there's going to be a lot of red tape I'm about to put up right now. Yes, he moves left to right really well. He doesn't throw, though, when he moves left to right, and that's what worries me against Zhumagulov. This could be one of those weird fights where Kopp wins like 29-28 on the scorecards. They're going to cut to the official graphic, and Zhumagulov's going to be up like 81 significant strikes to 27. It's just the ones that Kopp lands are probably going to be a lot cleaner, and that's what this fight comes down to. How does Kopp deal with the forward pressure of Zhumagulov? I think he can defend the takedown attempts, so that means it's primarily going to be contested on the feet. So how is he going to deal with the overall pressure of Zhumagulov? Because I know Zhalgas can stay for a solid 15 minutes fighting at that wonky pace of his. I'm not going to say it's a great pace. I'm not going to say it's a bad one.
He knew 25 minutes at the same
pace. It's so unique to him, though, and his style with all those looping weird shots that I don't think he's going to be able to finish Kopp. And I honestly don't think Kopp's going to be able to finish him either. He's probably going to go to decision. It's going to be a weird fight because I think Kopp's going to win, but I do think it's going to be one of those controversial decisions where the numbers might favor Zhalgas, but Kopp's going to land the more damaging shot.
Fight goes to the decision, minus 145.
It's not a bad bet.
Yeah, there's only one site that offers it. I like Kopp in this fight, and if you look at it for Jocko, as his nickname is over on Tapology, but not one with the UFC, you look at the losses. Albazi by decision, he is a great fighter and a technician when it touches the mat. Haliem Paiva, very good striker, big fight against Sean O'Malley coming up. Vartan Asatryan by decision, Zhifa Shang by split decision, and then that knockout loss to Asatryan. Listen, you can't win fights against, excuse me, old Vartan. But
everybody's got a kryptonite.
Big wins, but all of them by decision. I mean, Tyson Nam outside of the UFC, Tigir Ulanbekov outside of the UFC, Ali Bagutinov outside of the UFC, where a lot of people thought Ali won that fight, but yeah, I have this one going to a decision. I have Manel Cop winning. We're in agreement on this one?
We are, but every time Manel Cop fights, I feel like we're either going to get a star-making or breaking performance. Because he really is one big knockout away from everybody being like, oh, maybe he is the guy from Ryzen. But if he does continue to just have these close fights and decisions and, you know, missing weight and good performances against subpar competition, like, there's just always a by the way with Manel Cop. It would just be nice to see him go out there and get a solid win without any question marks surrounding it.
Big time fight. You let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Are you going with Kazakhstan's own Zhalgash Zhumagulov? Both of us going with Portugal's own Manel Cop, Starboy, to get the win. Big time fights coming up on this main card. Chris Curtis, Brendan Allen. Who else is there? Maki Patolo is fighting Dusko Todorovic. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. In a fight that feels like Mr. Perfect versus Ric Flair over in Raw, this seems like a loser leaves town. We have Hawaii's Maki Patolo taking on Serbia's Dusko Todorovic. And listen, I look at this fight and I cringe because these guys, they're 5 on in, it's bad. They're 2 or 3 on in, it's bad. For Dusko, you look at his last two fights. Lose to Punahele Soriano by knockout. Lose to Gregory Rodriguez by decision. Gets lit up in that fight. For Maki Patolo, it's 5 on in, let's have fun with it. Loses to Callum Potter in his UFC debut. He was supposed to fight Takashi Sato, missed weight, Takashi weighed in, his father just passed away. Like, it was a bad scene. It really was. It tugged at my heartstrings, that's why I mention it. Then he beats Charles Byrd, who was no longer in the UFC after that. Okay. Loses to Darren Stewart, loses to Impa Kasanganai, loses to Julian Marquez in the third round by submission. For Maki Patolo, it's been a weird run. I mean, his record right now is 13-8. There's spots in the UFC that I just sit and look at and I go, okay, but why isn't Albert Tumanov in? But Maki Patolo? And I mean no disrespect by that, but in terms of caliber of fighters and where guys are at in their career, look at the way that Albert Tumanov looked when he boxed Scott Sigmund at Triller Triad Combat. Hell, the guy is a win over Lorenz Larkin in the UFC. Bring him back. Sign him. Albert Tumanov. Either way, I'm fired up about that.
Didn't Alan Joban beat him?
Yeah, Alan Joban. No, he beat Alan Joban.
Okay, I just remember they fought.
He fought Alan Joban, and he fought, who else was it? Not Kamaru Usman, Leon Edwards. But that's neither here nor there. When I look at this fight, Matt, both of these guys have one giant fatal flaw. And for Dusko, it's more so than for Maki Patolo. That giant fatal flaw is the fact that he has a giant head, and he blocks punches with said head. And that is a huge red flag. Dusko Todorovic's striking defense is some of the poorest in the UFC, and it's at a 48% clip, and that's bad. That's really, really bad. And it's not just his UFC fights. Look at his fight against Michel Pereira, if you want an example, before they were in the UFC. Dusko gets backed up to the cage, stands there and eats a bunch of shots and gets finished. Okay. It's bad.
You sound like Stephen A. Smith describing Kwame Brown. He's got small hands. He can't catch the ball. He can't put a post move to memory. He can't finish. Like, let's try to spin this in a more positive light, shall we? Dusko, he's a pretty good offensive fighter. Like, when he's moving forward, going downhill, he's a tough fighter to deal
and
with.
And listen, I mean, if I didn't have my glasses on and I really kind of look from afar, it kind of looks like Dustin Poirier without the tattoos.
I was thinking, who's that guy who posts the picture of, like, his watch every morning about how early he wakes up? He's always
Mark
like...
Mark Wahlberg?
No. I don't know what his name is. He hangs out with Joe Rogan. They talk about eating elk meat, I think. I don't know. Dusko is a very odd fighter. And this time, I'm just going to set everything up. This should be a main event of a Contender Series fight night. Without a doubt. Loser goes home, and it's going to be a wild fight. The problem with Dusko, and you did say it perfectly, he has no striking defense. He has great offensive striking, but he's one of those fighters who the second he starts feeling himself, the hands start coming down. And yes, it helps you offensively because it's harder for your opponent to see the shots coming up from your hip, but it does leave your head wide open. And with Dusko, he's not somebody who has the footwork to get in and out of the pocket fast enough to where I'm comfortable with his hands being down by his side. Like, Wonderboy, for instance. Stephen Thompson can fight with his hands down by his hips. You know why? Because he's darting in and out of the pocket consistently. Whereas Dusko, he's going to get in, throw his strikes. And Teddy Atlas always says, oh, you don't wait around for the receipt after you pay. Dusko waits around for the receipt every time. It's like he admires his own work after he gets it off. And against Maki Patolo, listen, I think Dusko's the more talented guy. I think he's probably the more technical striker out of the two. But if your fatal flaw in your game is, I get hit by looping power shots, Mikey Bartolo is probably not the guy you want to be fighting in your I might be going home fighting the UFC. And with Bartolo, it's really weird because his fatal flaw is very different, but he does have one. He's going to stop leaning down in all of his fights. He leans down and gets submitted every time I've ever seen Mikey Bartolo fight. And it's just so odd. He's not really a panic wrestler. It's just when he gets pressured, be that against the cage with strikes or with wrestling, he does try to almost like meet it with his own wrestling. It's like he's trying to meet your shoulder with his own. And it gets him in bad positions all the time.
He's not going to have an issue in this one. No, Dushko, no, 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 no. Out of his UFC fights, I mean, did he find himself on the mat against Daquan Townsend? Yeah, he did. But Daquan Townsend. Murcielago MMA zone. He didn't really have the greatest UFC run. I mean, he fought Bavon Lewis. He lost to Bavon Lewis. Like, I don't really have a lot of positives to say about it. Todorovic is one of those guys that I went back for his last fight against Gregory Rodriguez. And if I'm not mistaken, I actually picked him in that fight. So listen, that's on me. But when I went back and did all the tape study, I threw the red flags up. I even went back. I watched the Contender Series fight against Teddy Ash. Dushko has a lot of success early. And then in the third round, Teddy Ash went, well, this isn't a unified fight because I've only ever fought for unified MMA. I'm just going to put my head right there in his chest, push forward and hit him. And it worked. And he blocked shots with his face. Like, that's just, when you look at numbers and they're just numbers on a page. And again, Todorovic, 54% striking accuracy, as I mentioned earlier, 48% striking defense. The accuracy is not bad. That striking defense is such a big red flag. It's awful. Patolo's isn't much better. 56%, but it's roughly average. But again, Dushko giving 5.71 significant strikes per minute. Taking 5.18. That's bad. Now, Patolo's average as to what he gives out, 4.20. That's not a 5.18.
He does get stopped in the first round in every other fight, though. So
that's it. So I do worry. Now, Dushko only has two losses. One to Soriano, one to Rodriguez. The losses for Patolo... Out of 21 fights, 8 have been losses. You look at them. Cassius Kane, he's good with Victory FC, loses that fight by knockout. He had beat Cassius Kane before that. Loses to Dakota Cochran, a guy that fought bare knuckle against Johnny Hendricks. And then again in the UFC, losses to Callan Potter, Darren Stewart, Impa Kasanganai, Julian Marquez. And oh, by the way, this fight was supposed to happen in June, but Bartolo was out due to an injury, so Dushko took a short notice fight against Gregory Rodriguez and ended up losing it. Matt? I don't have a whole lot more to add. I'm going to bring up the odds for this one. Patolo opened a plus 200. He's a plus 140 right now. Dushko Todorovic opened a minus 235. He's minus 170 right now. The Tapology votes for this one. They're going to be silly. You know they are.
Yeah.
Look at that. 1,175 total votes. 77% Todorovic. 34% by decision. 57% by knockout. For the 23% that have Patolo, 36% by decision. 53% by knockout. I think if Mikey Bartolo decides to put his wrestling shoes on for this fight...
I don't think he will.
That's where it gets really interesting, because I think he wins a fight that way. I know... I went through saying Todorovic has bad striking defense, but his striking's the best part of his game, and it's what got him to the dance.
Whoever moves forward is probably going to win this fight. The problem is, Bartolo hasn't really shown his wrestling capabilities against many top-level UFC guys. Just, it's been a struggle for him to at least secure the takedown, and with Todorovic... He's got, like, a weird body for this weight class. He's kind of like Alexander Volkanovski, to where he's not big, he's not small. He's just compact for the weight class. And I think it's going to be tough taking Todorovic down, especially if he's the one pressuring Bartolo up against the cage. The problem with Bartolo is he just gives up ground way too much. Like, he doesn't... Okay, I'm not going to absorb your combo, and now I'm moving forward. His only way to get any... to get his back off the cage is to use his wrestling. And when he does just shoot for those panic shots, I don't think he's going to be able to get them against a guy like Dushko. And trust me, I don't think Dushko is a great fighter in this division by any means whatsoever. But I do like his overall output against someone like Bartolo. And with Bartolo, you always got to worry about him landing that one big shot. But the way I look at this fight is both guys have the opportunity to land that one big shot. Dushko could win by first round knockout, so could Bartolo. I do at least like the output of Dushko slightly more. And if he can avoid that big shot, he should be able to start ramping up those numbers as the fight goes on.
I can't wait for the ha-ha, you guys are idiots, what are all those comments that are out there for this video. And please do, because if you know something that I don't about this fight, please share it with the class. Because it's as simple as the loser goes home, Ric Flair goes to WCW, Mr. Perfect stays with WWE.
CM Punk retains the title and Jeff Hardy goes home.
Matt Hardy versus Edge, wherever you want to slice it, that's how weird this fight is. I like Todorovic with his volume, where Pitolo hasn't matched that in the UFC. And again, could he sync something up? Sure. I think, again, if he starts to wrestle early, maybe wait. If the first round ends, Pitolo is wrestling, boom, I like Pitolo. But for me, in this one, I like the consistency of the striking output of Todorovic, and that's it. I'm going to sit here, I'm going to watch this fight, and then I'm going to move on to the next one.
Exactly. This is going to be a fun fight, so don't part any of your hard-earned money on it. Yeah, I like Dusko, though. It should be a really fun fight to watch.
Both of us going with Serbia's own Dusko Todorovic. In this one, you let us know down below who you have. And if we're totally wrong, which has happened before, it'll happen again. Big-time fights on this main card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Ho, 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 gentlemen. The holidays came early here at Manscaped, the leading men's hygiene brand. Manscaped just launched new products, including their all-new premium body wash. Look at that. And 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner, Matt. The bottoms of these are still actually wet because I just pulled them out of the shower. I've been using them since we got them from Manscaped. And listen, it's time to give yourself, or someone who needs it, the gift of beautiful skin, hair, and balls this holiday season. Go to manscaped.com. Use the code FNP for 20% off and free shipping. Listen, jingle balls to the walls, fellas. Listen up. I said it, and I'll say it again. So these actually just came out of the shower. Was I just in the shower? No, but before we came into the studio, I plucked these bad boys out of there because I've been using them for the past number of weeks now. They showed up in the mail if you've been following along with our ad reads. While I was away, Matt opened them. We looked at them. They look pretty cool. And since then, I have been very impressed with that same scent that you recognize from their cologne in their body wash and the 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner. Now listen, you want to make sure that you keep untrimmed pubes a thing of the past. And listen, it's possible that you have Santa's beard in your pants. So what you're going to want to do, Matt, look at this, cue it right up, is you're going to want to check out some of the products that they have, including the Perfect Package 4.0. We talked about it a lot, Matt. What are some of the highlights?
I mean, you've demonstrated on multiple occasions just how effective the nose hair trimmer is. And I'll do the slap for you. We know how good the salve and the ball deodorant is. Really, the nice thing was it started out with just ball trimmers, but they've really branched out. Now they cover pretty much all your men's hygiene needs. And now with the introduction of the body wash and shampoo, it just kind of helps round out all your necessities.
Shampoo. You never knew that you needed it, but Matt struggled. The weed whacker. It's definitely something you want to add to your game. And listen, if you're anybody like me and it's been a couple of weeks between events, you can hear that sucker working, as well as the Lawnmower 4.0. If you pick up that Perfect Package 4.0, you're going to get the Shed Travel Bag and the Manscaped Boxer Briefs as well. So listen, there's all sorts of great stuff over there, especially with that Cyber Monday type of feel going into the holidays. Make sure you check them out. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code FNP at manscaped.com. That's 20% off and free shipping, and use the code FNP over at manscaped.com. Clean up your nuts and make Santa proud this year, Matt. We have a big-time main card coming up. The Action Man, Chris Curtis, taking on Brendan Allen. In the co-main event, Riddell and Fazeev. And in the main event, Rob Font's taking on Jose Aldo. You're not going to want to miss it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Brett Tavares out. Ramon Dolidze out. Chris Curtis in. The Action Man, he's fighting for the second time in about a month, and he's going to be taking on Sanford MMA's own all-in Brendan Allen. The craziest thing about the guy who shares our nickname is that he has 21 professional fights, and if you look at it, he's only 25 years old. Very, very active fighter, and a guy whose game has continued to change and flow as he switched gyms and as he's had his performances. And for Allen, came into the UFC known as a primary grappler, but he's added wrinkles in his striking that you like to see. Now, did it get him in trouble against Sean Strickland? Sure it did. But again, you look at that Strickland fight, then he comes out and fights Carl Robertson, and he wins that fight by heel hook, and then he fights Punahele Soriano, and he looked pretty good striking in that one against the guy who can strike and who can wrestle. Now he's going to be taking on the Action Man Curtis, who just continues to win fight after fight. credit where it's due. Finally gets his UFC debut at age 34. Fighting Phil Haas, we wrote him off. Everybody wrote him off. Listen, Cody Saftick didn't. And Clint, diehard MMA pod, did not. So kudos to those guys. They got that fight right. Hey, we had Clint on ? It's 2 hours before the prelims. You should check it out for a final look at the card on Saturday. But for Chris Curtis, he just kind of did what Chris Curtis always does. He ate a lot of punishment at the start. Phil Haas did the old, ooh, I like that. Ooh, I like that. Look at that. That's a Jazz Chisholm autograph rookie. Ooh, I'm going to take that. And for Phil Haas, what he did was he just kept faking the takedown, looking like he was going to grab the knee and then going back up top. And then at a final point, Chris Curtis says, okay, well, I figured out what you're doing. Ooh. I'm just going to knock you out. Did not see that coming. Giant win for Chris Curtis. And again, this guy is a picture of consistency, and he's got a chin like no other. I absolutely love watching Chris Curtis fight.
Chris Curtis isn't going to beat himself. And that really does matter. Like, this is a guy who has been beaten multiple times in one night, decided to retire in that same night, and now he's in the UFC. Like, he's been through the ringer and made it out the other side. He's like Andy Dufresne. He crawled through a mile of shit just to get clean on the other side. Now, the good thing about Curtis, though, is he is kind of the same fighter he always has been. It's not like he has made these massive changes throughout his career. It just always sort of comes down to what does his opponent give him in the fight? Because like you said, he's not afraid to take a shot to give a shot. Sometimes he will lose a round to come back and win the last two. Like, he does have a lot of those like savvy veteran qualities that you really do like. And it's odd because it's taken him until that savvy veteran stage of his career for him to finally get notice on the biggest stage of them all. And you brought up his Tapology resume right now. Like, he's fought UFC caliber guys before he ever made it to the UFC. And I think that's a big deal because how many times do we come on here and we're like, hey, this prospect, they're really, really good. But you actually look at the people who they beat and they beat guys who are 1-3, 0-5. Like, yeah, they're good wins, but do they really mean that much? Chris Curtis is the complete opposite of that.
Win over Guns Out, Kyle Stewart back at XMMA1. That was a great card. Vic Fiallo in the main event. I like that one. Ray Cooper III, Magomed Kerimov, the fights with the PFL, didn't win those, but he did beat Andre Fiallo, so that was good. Then you go down through it. Beat Sean Lally on Contender Series.
Will Santiago?
Heartstrings. Will Santiago was in the UFC, although questionably, Nashawn Burrell was close to the UFC. Bilal Muhammad.
Like, these are really, really good names.
Forrest
for Pettz.
Tom Galecchio. Like, these are real names of people that actually matter in MMA. 35 pro fights for Chris Curtis. But again, in a fight against Brennan Allen, there's avenues for Chris Curtis to win. They're there.
Oh, they're so small, though. And that's what I keep on going back to. Remember what we said before the Phil Haas fight? It was, hey, Chris Curtis, he's super talented. He's going to be in the UFC for a while. It's just this is the matchup because Chris Curtis is more of a natural welterweight than he is a middleweight. And Phil Haas kind of showed that, at least early on in their fight. Haas was much bigger than Curtis. Brennan Allen is as big as a UFC middleweight can get. He is wide across the shoulders, and he's tall for the division, too. And all those openings that you had mentioned about how Phil Haas was feinting the takedown a lot, Brennan Allen could do all that stuff, but he's going to go and at least be more dedicated to a lot of those takedown attempts. And my big point with Allen, people are probably sick and tired of me bringing it up, there's guys like Brennan Allen, Grant Dawson, who else was on this card who I brought it up for? This is terrible TV, but Mickey Gall, like, there's guys who, when they get you on the mat, they make good use of that time. And Brennan Allen's a really good fighter for that. I always go back to his fight against, oh my goodness, how unprofessional of me. I always go back to his fight against Tom Breeze. And it wasn't just the fact that he looked good against Tom Breeze early on. It was once he got Breeze to the mat and he got that top control on him, he made great use of it. It was ground and pound, ground and pound, ground and pound. And then he got the stoppage not far after. Where Haas wasn't able to accumulate a lot of damage against Curtis early, even though the openings were there, I think it's going to be the exact opposite for Allen. I think Allen's going to be able to damage him a lot early on in this fight and really impose his size. And the difference between Allen, at least earlier on in his UFC tenure, and the Brennan Allen who's been fighting as of late was he wasn't with Sanford MMA until after that Sean Strickland performance. And I do think he started to show at least some of the striking IQ that you would like to see from that type of a move down to Sanford. Because sometimes people will change gyms and then they all of a sudden take on the new identity of that gym and they forget what got them to the dance in the first place. Brennan Allen didn't do that at all. Against Carl Roberson, he went out there, threw really nice kicks, was sound defensively, got the takedown, and completely dominated him on the mat. And then in his last fight against Punahele, he had continued to grow on his striking. I think we're just going to see another evolution in the Brennan Allen.
The only thing that scares me is the fact that Sanford MMA couldn't beat Chris Curtis once. What makes you think they can beat him again? Phil Haas, a training partner, Brennan Allen. So it's got to be weird there, too, because Allen would have had a little bit of a camp with Haas to get him ready for Curtis. He'd have some of those intricacies down.
Allen's much better than Phil Haas, though.
Maybe it helps him in this fight. The odds for this one. Allen open a minus 300 favorite. He's minus 352 right now. Chris Curtis open a plus 250. He's plus 270. If we have a look at Tapology, Matt, over under, I'm going to say 75% Allen. You going over?
I think over.
Yeah. We have a look right there. 973 total votes, 80% Allen, 47% by decision, 40% by submission. For the 20% that have Curtis, 75% by knockout. If you look at Curtis's last five fights, they've all been in 2021. Knocks out Kyle Stewart, knocks out Juan Ramon Grano Medina, knocks out Jerome Hatch, decision win over Kenny Robertson, and then a knockout win over Phil Haas. Man, Phil Haas had a bad year that way.
And a
questionable
chin.
Chris Curtis had one of the best years you've seen going in MMA. Like, 2021's been great for him at 34. It'd be awesome to see him get another win. I can't side with him. I like Brennan Allen here, but I can't wait to hear from everybody in the comments section because I know there's a ton of people that love to watch Chris Curtis fight.
And how could you not? Like, this is going to be a really fun fight, win, lose, or draw, but I still like Brennan Allen quite a bit.
Both of us going with our namesake. We're going with a guy from Wisconsin in Brennan Allen, or should I say Louisiana, then Wisconsin, then Florida from Allen. But a big-time fight for him coming up this weekend. If you like Allen, let us know down below in the comments section. If you like Curtis, let us know down below in the comments section. Big time fights on this main card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
A couple of marquee prospects in the UFC's light heavyweight division battling it out. Two of six of the ranked fighters on this card and on this main card. We have, is it Jim? Is it Jimmy? We have Mr. Crute taking on Sweet Dreams Are Made of These, Jamahal Hill, coming off his first career loss and his probably first life elbow dislocation against one ranked fighter, Paul Craig. And it was a crazy fight where pre-fight Jamahal Hill was really feeling his jiu-jitsu, and post-fight, I mean, he took some pictures with Paul Craig, but he probably wasn't feeling his jiu-jitsu so much. Trains out of Black Lion Jiu-Jitsu, does Jamahal Hill. But this is such an interesting fight stylistically, because if you look at Hill, and if you just focus on his UFC career, beats Darko Stozic, looks very good in that fight. Beats Clidson Abreu, but the fight's overturned to a no contest.
He beat Clidson Abreu.
Beats Ovince St. Preux, knocks him out, and then loses to Paul Craig because he was feeling himself a little bit too much, and it just didn't go all that great. If you look at Jimmy Crute, especially the 5-on-in, finish win over Sam Alvey, lost to Misha Cirkunov, where Cirkunov really dominated him. Beats Michael Olishchuk, you love to see that. Beats Modestus Bukauskas. Again, he'll be back someday in the UFC. You know he will. He will. And then he loses to Anthony Smith by TKO because, listen, sometimes leg kicks get wonky to the outside of your knees. So for Crute, he's been out for a very long time. His last fight was about 7 months ago. For Jamahal Hill, the elbow dislocation 5 months ago. We've seen fighters get their elbows dislocated. Pat Sabatini, happened to him on the regional scene, comes into the UFC, lights the world on fire. So for Hill, listen, all's not lost without one loss. For Crute, you lose to Anthony Smith that way, listen, all's not lost there either. So both guys have a big opportunity in a big way to make a second, third, fourth, fifth impression on the fans. This does hold, though, very major implications for the division, because we talk about guys in the 10 to 15 range at the light heavyweight division. You're talking the Uzdemirs, you're talking the Smiths, you're talking the, hell, where's Dominic Reyes these days? I know these guys aren't right there in that 10 to 15, but you're going to fight those guys when you win this fight. So it does hold major implications for this division.
Exactly. You grow up really fast in the 205-pound division. And that's why I really like this fight, actually. Because you're giving both guys a good chance to reset after their previous performance. Because you know Jim Crute is better than the guy who fought Anthony Smith his last time out. And the same thing has to be said for Jamahal Hill, too. And I remember clearly before that fight saying, Jamahal Hill is the better fighter than Paul Craig. But I hate all the quotes I've heard out of him this week. And it's very rare that we can actually actually say, like, hey, it paid off to listen to those quotes throughout the week, but it was true. Like, Jamal Hill jumps into the guard of Paul Craig. I don't know if you've ever seen Paul Craig fight before, but, like, hey, one of the most dangerous guys in the world on the ground, and he gets his arm broken. The thing about Hill, though, is that before that fight, he was probably the biggest prospect the division had had since, like, Johnny Walker. And I know that doesn't seem that long ago, but still, like, he had a lot of hype and a lot of momentum behind him. And I don't think we can forget about just how crafty of a striker he is based on that one submission loss to Paul Craig. Because with Hill, he's a very unique fighter. He has a very wide stance, although he's not super kick-heavy. He does rely a lot on his boxing because he's someone who uses his feet more as, like, a range finder than an actual weapon in the fight. It's going to be weird against Jimmy Crute because with Crute, he's just a frustrating fighter to watch. In the Anthony Smith fight, okay, you thought if he gets him to the ground, if he can get on top of him, he should be able to dominate Smith. But if you can have a really good jab, if you have good leg kicks, if you just have those good long-range weapons, it's almost like Crute just won't come into your range in the first point. Like, you can keep him really far away in your fights, and that's what this is going to come down to for Jamal Hill. If Hill can keep Crute at the outset of his reach, jab, jab, and then step in with power shots, then I think Hill's going to be able to knock him out, probably. Like, that's how confident I am in the overall hand speed and power Hill has. But the issue is that Crute, on his best day, does look like a future champion. He is someone who can go out there, mix in his single legs with his power double legs. Physically, he's one of the biggest guys in this division. And when his striking does look good, and when he is able to mix it in with his wrestling, Jim Crute really does look like he could be one of those future top 10 guys for a very long time.
Yeah, and I mean, future top 10 KSW heavyweight Darko Stuzic, he was able to get 6 of his 9 takedown attempts against Jamal Hill, but he couldn't hold him down, and then he got outstruck at about a 3-1 clip. Hill outstruck Stuzic, ends up winning that fight by unanimous decision. Since then, Hill hasn't been taken down against Abreu, against OSP, against Paul Craig. No real takedowns from those guys. But again, 57% takedown defense is skewed for Hill because of how many Stuzic went for, but he wasn't able to hold him down. So that's a giant factor there. But for Crute, 80% takedown accuracy, and that is a thing in his fights. Now, if you're kicking him to the breadbasket, if you're landing a really good jab, if you're making it difficult for Crute to make the entries, yeah, he's really going to struggle. But he's one of the more powerful grapplers and MMA wrestlers that you're going to find, period.
I do agree with that, but I will say he has a hard time holding guys down sometimes. Like, we saw that in the Serkinov fight. He gets the takedown, Serkinov scramble, 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 and he just doesn't stop, and he's able to get on top. I understand as one of the top-level grapplers, but still, Crute has shown the inability to hold down the top-level guys. I don't doubt his ability to go out there and get the takedown, but when you combine his, I guess, just uncomfortableness on the feet with his inability to close that distance, I do worry about him. Now, this is going to be one of those fights where I think this is one-way traffic written all over it. I think if Jamal Hill wins, he's going to kick that front leg of Jimmy Crute and probably knock him out early in the fight, if we're being honest, because Hill has that kind of power. I don't think we can just take his last performance and throw everything out. Like, I think we have to remember just how promising of a prospect Jamal Hill was up until that Paul Craig fight, because I almost want to compare his striking a little bit to, like, a light heavyweight cowboy without the head kicks. Like, he's got a great check knee up the middle. He's found ways to damage guys, and they do go for takedowns. Like, there's a lot to like out of the game of Hill. But Crute has all those weapons that you look for as, oh, well, he can get a high volume of takedowns. He can push a heavy pace. That's why this fight is so fun. And that's why this is a really good kind of, like, it's just, you get to kind of wash the bad taste out of your mouth from your last performance, but it's going to be wild to think that either one of these guys could be on a two-fight losing streak. Like, Jim Crute's going to be one of the better light heavyweights in the last 5 years to go on a two-fight losing streak if he loses this, and the same would have to be said for Jamal Hill.
If you look at the odds, Crute opened a minus 220 favorite, minus 184 right now. For Hill, he opened a plus 185, he's plus 152. Topology vote, surprise to us as they are to you. We haven't looked at them, and look at that. It is 1,320 total votes, 79% Crute, 55% by submission, 19% by knockout. For the 21% that have Hill, 65% by knockout. And I could definitely see that. Crute going in on a lazy entry or a long across the cage type of entry, Hill knocking him out cold. And he has that kind of power. He's such a tricky southpaw too. He's a really hard guy to figure out. And it was like young OSP, old OSP when they fought. And look at exactly what the man in Jamal Hill was able to do. The other crazy thing is, this is a guy with, what, 10 professional fights, and he's 30. Like, it's crazy to think of it that way as well. So, Matt, when we look at this fight, it is a hard one to pick. Who are you going with here?
It is a hard fight to pick, but I know I've read it the size of Jim Crute. Jamal Hill's always 10 times bigger than I think he is. Like, when I think about Jamal Hill fighting at this division, I always picture him as like, oh, he's sort of like a blown-up middleweight. And then he gets to face-offs, and you're like, oh, no, he towers over everybody who he fights. It just, when I first thought about this fight and breaking it down, I thought Crute would have a massive size advantage, like he does over most guys who he fights, but that will not be the case in this matchup. And I guess the X factor you have to look for is, can Crute hold Hill down? Because I don't doubt he can take him down. Of course he can. He takes down pretty much everybody he fights. But can he hold him down? Because Crute does struggle with holding some guys down. And Hill's really good at popping back up to his feet. He does have that strange takedown defense where it's like, yes, you might get him down or you might be able to trip him up. But his first move back up to his feet really is dangerous. I think we're going to go with Jimmy Crute, though. I've seen him struggle on the feet enough to where I'm a little bit worried about him at range with a guy like Jamal Hill, but I do think that if he can get on the inside and at least get a takedown early in the fight, it's going to make Hill at least hesitant enough on the feet to where he's not going to be going out there throwing his big bombs, and unless Hill does land one of those big shots, I think Crute will be able to just at least go to the wrestling a lot. Now, does that guarantee a win for Crute? Not by any means, but if he at least does wrestle for 10 out of the 15 minutes, it's going to make him less likely to get knocked out.
Crute went 8 of 10 takedowns against Michael Oleshchuk, and in that fight, he won it by submission. He needed 8 takedowns for 3 minutes of control time to finish him. Oleshchuk kept getting back up, so Hill's got a good opportunity. Again, it's happened against Stuzic.
I worry about Hill's volume, honestly, because with Hill, I know he can go out there and knock out Crute, without a doubt. Unless he does get the one big action, I don't know if he can do enough on the in-betweens.
I like Crute with the wrestling, but I am very hesitant, and I want to hear from the commenters down below. You let us know who you have in this fight. I've got Jimmy Crute as it stands, but I can't wait to see these guys on Friday. Face off, come back to you on Question Mark Kicks on Saturday. Have that realization again that, yeah, Jamal Hill, he's pretty big. Yeah, maybe he can defend some of those takedowns. He'll do well just like he did in that Stuzic fight. That is exactly what we will see. But yeah, let us know who you have down below in the comments section. Great fight coming up this weekend. And hey, Leonardo Santos, my guy, fighting Clay the Carpenter Guida in the co-main event. Fazeev taking on Riddell in the main event. Font Aldo, you're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. Big time fight coming up this weekend at lightweight. We have Clay the Carpenter Guida, a guy that has spoiled title opportunities for big time fighters like Anthony Pettis in the past. And he's looking to spoil a return to the win column for the 41-year-old Ultimate Fighter winner, Leonardo Santos. Now, was that Ultimate Fighter this year? No, it was many years ago. Was this a guy that, listen, had an MMA debut in 2002? Yeah, it is. And for Leonardo Santos, if you go back through the record, that's the craziest part about it. His MMA debut was at Shooto Treasure Hunt 7 in June 29th of 2002, against Takanori Gomi, who was probably the best lightweight in the world at that time. If it wasn't him, it was BJ Penn. If it wasn't BJ Penn, it was Jens Pulver. It was somebody good in 2002, and Takanori Gomi was among the best. Leonardo Santos has had the highest of highs, including wins over Kevin Lee. He's also had fights where it was kind of close, and then he was maybe going to win against Grant Dawson, and then he looked awful at the end of it, and Grant Dawson looked great. And that's the scary thing. For Santos, the question always was, when will his age catch up with him? Might have been in his last fight against Grant Dawson. Oh, by the way, that was this year, 8 months ago, where he did lose that fight. But if you look at the 5-1-in, Kevin Lee, he beat him by finish.
Almost six years ago.
Beat Adriano Martins. Adriano Martins knocked out Islam Makhachev. That fight was 5 years and a month ago. Knocked out Stevie Ray 2.5 years ago.
It was yesterday to Craig, though.
Beat Roman Bogatov by decision 1 year and 4 months ago. But in that fight, Roman Bogatov fought like Clay Guida does, except Clay Guida doesn't do illegal shots and get kicked out of the UFC because he means well. He's the Carpenter. He trains at a Team Alpha Male. Roman Bogatov went in there and went Nutshot City. He tried every trick in the book. He fought like Ric Flair in an MMA cage, and it didn't work for him, and the promotion said, go back. Just see you later. You're gone. Pack your stuff and go. Leonardo Santos, though, as much as I like him, he's one of my guys on Early Stoppage, our podcast here. I talk about him all the time. I used to. I just wanted to see more of him. His last fight scared me because he looked old, but that was against a super prospect lightweight. I will say that.
And, well, good news. He's fighting another one of those this weekend. No, he's fighting another old man. And this is the thing. Leonardo Santos might be older chronologically, like he was born first. He's still the younger guy in this matchup, though, because he hasn't taken nearly as much damage as Clay Guida has throughout his career. And the problem with Guida is he can't just go out there and get a takedown at this stage of his career. He doesn't have the strength behind his takedown attempts anymore. And that's why I don't know how Clay Guida wins this fight, if I'm being honest. Like, his strikes are wild, and he doesn't have great accuracy on them anymore. Like, he did back in the day where he would just throw a crazy amount of volume, but, like, now he just has the volume, but his range isn't great anymore. He doesn't have the best takedown numbers anymore. I just don't know what Clay Guida can do to go out there and beat Leonardo Santos. And I might be worried about Santos's 41-year-old age, but I still think he's the more consistent guy at this stage of his career. I really do. And Guida doesn't really have finishing capabilities at this stage of his career. If he did, I might see an avenue where he could win. But if this fight goes to decision, Santos could win. If it gets stopped, then it's definitely Santos the one stopping Guida. I don't know what Guida can do to go out there and beat Leonardo Santos. This is a weird fight. I understand why they did it. It's two guys around 40. It makes sense. I think they're very different versions of 40, though.
I'll explain to you why. Clay Guida still has a high output of strikes. It's a high output.
He does.
How accurate is it? Doesn't really matter. What do the judges see? Do they have a monitor in front of them with the striking numbers? No, they don't. So they have to make a judgment call. Guida's one
so
of those guys.
So we're never bringing up striking accuracy ever
when,
again.
No, but when the hair pops out of the ponytail and it starts moving around and he does the old get rowdy, he gets wins. And if you look at it in his last fight against Mark O. Madsen in a co-main event slot, Madsen started to slow down, but Guida kept the same pace. Now, striking numbers are going to tell you a different story, but just listen to me. Go back and watch the fight and listen to me. Guida kept the same pace, if not a little bit of an uptick as the fight went on. If you want the numbers, I'll give them to you. In that fight, round one, 18 total strikes for Guida. Round 2, 26. Round 3, 31. There was an uptick in the strikes and an uptick in the volume and in the pressure. And Madsen's cardio started to go way down as that fight went on. He did not look like the same fighter round 1 to round 3. It's because the output was really high in the first round and it went down.
We predicted that, though.
Clay Guida presses a big-time pace. He puts a lot of volume on you. The good thing for Santos is he has pop on the end of his shots.
A lot
of it. The bad thing for Santos is he's closer to 42 than he is 41, and he lost emphatically to Grant Dawson. And again, I can't say this enough. Dawson's a super prospect. That's a good win for Dawson. It's a bad loss for Santos at the same time. I can definitely see a world where Guida wins this fight by decision, and it would not surprise me in the least, and it pains me to say it somewhat because, again, I've done videos. We have a video on this channel with a thumbnail of guys that you should pay attention to, and Leonardo Santos is the guy in the thumbnail. Like, this is how much stock I've had in this guy throughout my career in MMA media. I look at the odds for this one. Santos open to minus 260 favorite, minus 185 right now. Guida open to plus 220 is plus 152. If we have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt, I'm going to say over under 65% Santos.
Way over. Saying.
Way over. 1,246 total votes, 75% Santos, 57% by decision, 24% by submission. For the 25% that have Guida, 80% by decision. So, Matt, we have a fight between Santos, a guy that can definitely finish a fight. Performance of the night bonus wins over Stevie Ray and Kevin Lee. UFC 198, Aldo McGregor. That's when Santos got a performance bonus over Kevin Lee. UFC Fight Night, Gustafson Smith is when he got one over Stevie Ray. Stevie Ray.
Clay Guida's been fighting in the UFC since 2006. I just, if we're going to bring up both guys having weird losses and weird wins, it's just...
Fought UFC debut October 14th, 2006 against Justin James, submission of the night.
So if we're going to bring up how, Santos is old because he got a bonus on a Conor McGregor pay-per-view, then I think we should probably tell the story from both sides. Clay Guida had a close fight against a guy, and we predicted exactly how that fight would go, Craig. I'm going to pat us both on the back. We said Marco Madsen would get tired as it go on, and Clay Guida would look better than he probably has in the past few years. That fight went how we thought it would. I still don't think he has a chance in this one. I don't. The thing was, Madsen doesn't have much for finishing capabilities himself, so you figure that fight would go to a decision, which plays into Clay Guida's hand. Guida's not going to go for many takedowns in this fight because Santos is that tricky on the mat, so you're going to have to be worried about getting submitted the whole time if you go for takedowns. On the feet, Guida can't stay in the pocket with Santos because Santos has legitimate knockout power, and Guida doesn't. So the only way Guida wins this fight is if he gets Santos up against the cage like he did against BJ Penn and just unloads on him with combinations. Now, BJ Penn may have actually been younger at the time than Santos is now, but It's one of those, like, hey, you got to judge the fighter on how much damage they've taken throughout their career, not just how old they are. And I still look at Santos, the younger, more fresher fighter in this matchup, and that's why I like him.
I hate Santos behind the black line. I hate him on his back foot. I hate how much...
That's how he knocked out Stevie Ray, though.
The lack of output that he has. But he did knock down Stevie Ray and finish him, and he did knock down Kevin Lee and knocked... Well, yeah, you get the knockout win there. But the inactivity, and again, he's not active when he fights. I don't like the reservedness of Leonardo Santos. I can't pick him in this fight as much as it pains me. I'm taking the underdog Clay Guida in this one. And if you want to call me mean names, go for it. I really don't care at this point. Matt, we're disagreeing on the pick. You've got Nova Uniaos, Leonardo Santos. I'm going with Team Alpha Males forever title challenger. The guy's just going to be in the headlights, spotlights. He's going to be headlining BKFC fights. Hopefully later than sooner.
No, I never want to see Clay Guida in BKFC, ever.
If Chad Mendez is doing it, then Guida's going to do it. But Matt, I've got Guida, you've got Santos. Brad Riddell's taking on Rafael Fiziev in the co-main event. And in our main event this weekend, holy smokes, Rob Font, Jose Aldo. You're not going to want to miss it. I'm so excited for it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
They've been spending most of their lives living in a striker's paradise. We have former Tiger Muay Thai striking coaches squaring off ranked lightweights in the UFC in this co-main event. Thank goodness it's only three rounds. Brad Quake Riddell taking on Rafael Adaman Fiziev. And as far as their backgrounds go, very, very similar past. These guys have fought in the biggest of Muay Thai stadiums. They have headlined as far as exactly what they can do. And we've seen those primary skill sets play out in the UFC to great effect. For Rafael Fiziev, he loses to Magomed Mustafayev, and then he racks off four big wins. You want the names? I'll give them to you. He beats Alex White. He beats Mark Chiesa. He beats Renato Moicano. Not only beats him, he knocks him out. And then he beat Bobby Green in his last fight. That fight giving a lot of people pause, and we'll talk about that one later on. For Brad Riddell, he's been around, not as many fights in the UFC, but he beats Jamie Mullerkey in an all-timer, beats Magomed Mustafayev by split decision, beats Leko Alex Da Silva, and his last time out, he beats Drew Dober. You talk about the skill gap for Fiziev, you look at the way that he's fought out from Mustafayev to his last fight against Bobby Green, big names. You talk about it for Riddell, decent names, but to go from Alex Da Silva to then his last fight against Drew Dober, that's a giant jump in competition in a stacked division. Matt, since this fight was announced, people hit me up at Craig Allen FNP, all over Twitter, Instagram, whatever, sending me the fact that this fight's going to happen. I couldn't be more excited. Like, I can't believe this is going to happen, and I won't believe it until these guys make the walk, and then they shut the door, and then they do the introductions, and then they start fighting. Because listen, I am so... This is Christmas came early for me.
This is a really fun fight, and this is a personal fight for both guys, because whoever wins has legitimate bragging rights of like, hey, I'm not only the better fighter, I'm the better coach too, and better coach at a similar gym, or at the same gym at one point. This is very weird though, and I might get pushback for this, but these guys don't strike in a similar way at all. Like, just because they both do Muay Thai doesn't mean they both express that Muay Thai in the same way, and I'm gonna get a little like... We're going to go into the mindset here for a second, but I always go into... Matt Brown said this about... he was on the Joe Rogan podcast, which I don't watch, but I really like Matt Brown, so of course I'm going to listen. And what Matt Brown said has always stuck with me. He goes, you don't practice mixed martial arts. You practice mixed martial skills. How you do them is you doing MMA. Like... And I kind of apply that to these guys. Like, both these guys practice skill sets in Muay Thai, but they express that Muay Thai in very different ways. For Riddell, he's almost more of a traditional boxer the way he does fight. He's going to march you down. He has a much higher guard than Fiziev, and he's much less reliant on his own kicking offense to really start to go downhill and land with his combinations. Whereas Fiziev, he's a much rangier striker. He likes to bounce a lot more, especially when he is sort of at that medium range where neither guy is doing much. He bounces a lot more, and he throws a lot more kicks too, and that's gonna be the really interesting thing about this fight. I know we're gonna talk about leg kicks a lot more when we get to the main event later on, but Fiziev is someone who will throw a lot of kicks offensively early on in a fight. And I know you're gonna want to get to the Bobby Green performance here in a second, so I guess I'll lead it in with this. He threw a lot of kicks against Bobby Green early. They were great. They landed. They looked really good. What's the problem with throwing a lot of kicks in a fight? They drain your gas tank like few other things do. And what happened to Fiziev against Bobby Green?
This is all anybody's going to talk about. I'm going to talk about the votes that we have out there in the YouTube community tab. I will read your comments. Trust me, they're coming. But this is all I have to say about Fiziev. Does he have a bad gas tank? Sometimes. That's the weird thing. Sometimes. Look at the fight that he had against Mark Chiesa. Striking totals round by round. Round 1, 21 strikes. Round 2, 28 strikes. Round 3, 33 strikes. Against Bobby Green, round 1, 25 strikes. Round 3, 36 strikes. Round 4, 43 strikes. But he got tired. What? That doesn't compute.
But stats don't always tell the full picture of the
exactly.
Fight.
If you look at the way that Fiziev fights, he's throwing spinning wheel kicks. He's throwing leg kicks. He's throwing power hooks. And they land early. But then as the fight goes on, his hands start to go down. And his breathing starts to be more in his stomach. And he really starts to slow down. Throw at a more labored pace. Still accurate with the shots. But he does slow down and let the other fighter creep in the second round and the third round. Or at least create the doubt in your mind, my mind, and the judge's minds as well.
Now, I have a bit of a hot take that I want to get your opinion on. Because I know you're a bit outspoken. The Bobby Green fight was very close. I don't know. Fiziev won that fight, though,
yeah,
right?
I thought Fiziev won it, yep.
I think Drew Dober has a real argument for beating Brad Riddell in their last fight. I really do. And I know a lot of people aren't going to agree with me on this one. Drew Dober, right after the fight, had put out a tweet. And he was like, listen, I just don't understand how I lost it. It was as close of a fight as you can get. Like, he rocks Brad Riddell multiple times throughout that fight. Like, genuinely hurts him on the feet. And that's not really something a lot of people thought they would have seen. Like, Riddell's this really credited Muay Thai practitioner. He's got great boxing. He's got a great chin. But when Dober made that fight ugly, and when he did get on the inside, he was able to hurt Riddell with power shots. And this is another thing I always go back to when we break down a Brad Riddell fight. He's not big for the weight class, but this weight cut is hard on him. Like, it really is. And I don't understand weight cutting. I'll be the first one to admit it. Like, Max Holloway can look awful the day before a fight, show up the next day and throw 1,000 strikes and act like it never affected him. Brad Riddell cannot look like that big of a lightweight, but you always hear the stories like, oh, there's 5 minutes left, like, for the weigh-in window, and Brad Riddell still hasn't weighed in, and, oh, like, this one was really hard compared to the last ones. Like, there's always an oh, by the way, with Brad Riddell weighing in, and that does worry me, because that does affect your chin, and maybe Drew Dober can't put you down with his power when you do have a limited capacity to absorb a shot, but if Fiziev gets on the inside early in a fight and throws one of those like body head combos similar to what he was able to do against Moicano, you don't want to have a bad weight cut, especially in the first round of that fight. And I'm going to reinforce a point that you had made. It is interesting. They are very different at the start of a fight in the way that they do fight. Fiziev starts to turn into Brad Riddell, though, the later the fight goes. He does become much more boxing-oriented, and he does forget a lot of his kicks. And that's the way I look at this fight. I think Fiziev's going to win this fight as long as he stays a Muay Thai fighter. When he becomes a boxer, that's when I think Brad Riddell can start to take over, because Riddell is always that same consistent fighter. Does he fight it? A crazy pace? Not really. He's just very consistent. I always use Ian Heinisch as my example before his recent struggles, but you get the idea. Just as a fighter who, from round one to round three, no matter what the pace of the fight is, he's still going to look like pretty much the exact same guy. Riddell has that kind of cardio, whereas Fiziev, he looks like he can go Super Saiyan that first round, but then he looks kind of average in the third. So more than any other fight on this card, I really do feel like cardio plays a key.
Fight of the night bonuses, two of them for each guy for Fiziev against Bobby Green, UFC 265. That was a fight of the night. Great and fight. At UFC Fight Night, Figueiredo versus Benavidez 2, we got a fight of the night against Mark Chiesa. If you look at it for Brad Riddell, fight of the night in his last fight against Drew Dober, fight of the night in his debut against Jamie Mullerkey. He also got rocked in that fight. But when I look at this fight, yeah, the one big X factor is the fact that Brad Riddell, not just his last fight where he did somehow get 5 takedowns on
Dober
Drew
Dober.
Dober
did pop up immediately, though.
But the weird thing is, sometimes Riddell will engage in the grappling. He's not great defensively, but he also pops back up to his feet.
He does.
But he will implement it into his game. Fiziev's not going for takedowns, and he stuffs every single one of them. So it'll be interesting to see how it works out for him, because for Fiziev, he went from Tiger Muay Thai to Sanford MMA, and that's kind of the real X factor. I've seen a lot of pictures on the Instagrams of Fiziev training with a whole litany of fighters in the lower weight classes, even 170 and down below. And I've also seen a lot of, well, their newer coach, and Nick Lentz in a lot of those. So I think Nick Lentz is a great guy for a fight like this, because you're going to train those defensive chops. You're already a good striker. If Brad Riddell, even there's a shout of a doubt that he's going to go for a takedown attempt, I think Fiziev, round one, great takedown defense. Round two, round three, it's been there, so I have no reason to doubt it. That's the only thing that I'll say. It's been there. It's been there tried and true and tested for all three rounds. It's just, can Fazeev keep a pace for three? Because I know Riddell can. I know he can. So, Matt, this is where we're going to throw it on over to everybody in the YouTube community tab, because I want to get their point of view. I threw it out there today. Ranked Strikers Paradise with Pragmarites on the line. It's like I started this video that way. UFC Vegas 44 co-main. Who have you got? 1,000 votes. 53% Fazeev, 47% Riddell. So let's throw it on over to you. You guys make this show happen. From our first commenter, Ishin, saying, pretty sure Riddell wins, but Fazeev is a beast.
He is.
Next one, don't understand how Riddell is an underdog. Seems like it'll be a clear 29-28 Riddell. Fazeev starts strong, then gasses, and Riddell starts slow, but gets better as the fight goes on. We'll give it to a couple more, Matt. Theodore Hoesny is saying, Fazeev gassed so bad after round one and round two. Having cardio in the lightweight division is a huge no-no, even if you have power. We'll go to another one. Akash Deep saying, banger of a fight. I got Fazeev, but should be an amazing night. They continue on and on, and if I didn't read your comment, I appreciate all of them, and I'll talk about the YouTube community tab for our main event as well. But Matt, in this fight, it seems like everybody is talking about Fazeev's cardio. It was a giant highlight in his last fight. It seems like the only talking point. Can you talk me away from that in this one?
Whoever breaks character first is going to lose. If Brad Riddell shoots for a takedown before Fazeev turns into a boxer, then I think Brad Riddell is going to lose. Like, if Brad, the earlier Riddell shoots for a takedown, the more likely I think he's going to lose the fight. Because this is the problem. You have two guys who are both Muay Thai coaches, who both coached at the exact same place. They're going to want the bragging rights of outstriking their opponent. Brad Riddell's not coming into this fight thinking, I'm going to take down Fazeev and just try to muster out, like, some kind of wrestling win. Like, I really do think there's going to be some bravado behind both guys' mindset to this, and I really like Fazeev in this matchup. Speed kills in MMA, and I think Fazeev is the much faster fighter. I really do. Like, you look at some of Fazeev's combinations, especially in tight, he lights guys up. Bobby Green has some of the best defensive boxing in the UFC, and when Fazeev was on the inside against him, he made him look like he didn't even belong there. Now, yes, when Green was able to start crashing forward and just kind of sort of being when he became unorthodox, he was having success. But that was the big key to that fight. When Green was technical, he was struggling. When he made it ugly, that's when he was able to have success. I don't know if that's part of Brad Riddell's game. I think no matter what, he's going to try to stay technical. And if he does shoot for takedowns, it's because there's something on the feet that he's seeing that he's not liking. So, against my better judgment, because I normally don't like picking guys who do seem to have the worst cardio out of the two, I like Fazeev. I think if he can go with the leg kicks early, that's going to take some of the oomph out of Brad Riddell's game. And I think Fazeev goes to the body enough to even out some of the cardio. When you think about Fazeev at his best, again, it's not just the leg kicks. It's not just the left hook. He goes to the body a lot, and I think those strikes are going to be open against Riddell.
I've seen Riddell get rocked and cracked. Not to say that Mullerkey's not a bad fighter. Not to say that, hell, Drew Dober's a good... Like, these guys are good fighters, but I've seen Riddell get cracked. I've seen Fazeev get finished by Magomed Mustafayev, but personally, I think very highly of him. So it is a weird one. There's so many comparables, you know, Tiger Muay Thai notwithstanding. I like Fazeev ever so slightly, but if you have a fight on this card where you're going, man, I gotta tell all my friends about it, I gotta have the popcorn ready, I might even go to the theater and buy a big bag of popcorn. I'll spend $20 in gas.
He's just gonna rent out a whole theater for himself to watch this fight.
I might, and I'm gonna look like Shia LaBeouf watching his own movies. I'm gonna have tears going down my face watching this fight. You have no idea how excited about this one.
Brad Riddell versus Rafael Fazeev, make a grown man cry.
And I mean, like, again, we do this every week. Honest to goodness, I don't care who wins.
It's just a great fight.
I'm just there for the fight. I've got Kyrgyzstan's Rafael Fazeev to get the win, but if you tell me that New Zealand's Brad Riddell's gonna get it, awesome. I want to hear from you. I want to hear from everybody down below in the comments section. We do our best to respond and bring them up in the shows as well. You can find us at Fight Night Picks on Instagram, Twitter, at Craig Allen FNP, at Matt Allen FNP. Enjoy your weekend. Heck of a fight. And oh, by the way, the main event's pretty good too. You're going to want to stick around for that. Rob Font taking on Jose Aldo. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Absolutely amazing fight in our main event coming up this weekend. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. If you haven't, you should. With me to my left, to your right, as always, our second half, the Fight Night Picks crew, Matt Allen FNP. You can find our third, John Franklin, Sunday Morning Corner Man. There's Joshua Hart. There's Ian Wynn. It actually goes on quite a bit. Make sure you check out the team, but we have an amazing fight coming up in this main event with possible title implications. I say that, but probably not on the line. between Rob Font and Jose Aldo, a fight that I really never thought I would see, but it's going to be something that we get. The greatest featherweight of all time, and I'm not afraid of saying that. I don't care who knows it. Jose Aldo, who had that awful losing streak. There was Volkanovski. There was Moraes. There was Piotr Jan. You look at the last two, a win over Marlon Vera, a win over Pedro Munhoz, and Aldo's gotten back to the things that got him to the dance, that made him popular, that made him the king of Rio, the Burger King of Rio, some would say. But you look at it for Aldo, and in these last two fights, the leg kicks come back a little bit of the wrestling, a little bit of the grappling, and he's had success in those areas. And for Rob Font, and I'm going to talk about it more as the video goes on, I never knew what to expect at Rob Font. I never knew how to gauge Rob Font. And personally, I can't remember the last time I picked Rob Font to win a fight. We said that before we started. You picked him to beat Garbrandt, but I didn't. I had Cody Garbrandt. I thought, you know what? Maybe Garbrandt's going to put the wrestling shoes on. And he tried, and it didn't work. And I thought Moraes was going to beat him. Well, didn't, because he knocked him out. So if you look at it for the five on in for Font, he loses to a Sun Sal about 3 years ago. He beat Sergio Pettis. That was a big fight. Like, I remember the vibes for that one. That felt like a big fight. He beats Ricky Simone. He beats Moraes. And his last time out, he beats Garbrandt. And he looked better than he's ever looked. That was an amazing performance. Now he gets Jose Aldo in a main event. And oh, by the way, Rob Font's the favorite in this fight, too. Man, credit where it's due, because this man out of Massachusetts who holds that Puerto Rican flag with him proudly is a great fighter, and this is an awesome opportunity for him.
I'm going to bring up a quote that you had said to me that we both listened to in a podcast. Rob Font's kind of like Paul George. Like, you don't look at him and think, oh, I could never do that one day. Like, what Rob Font does isn't like, he's not like Yair Rodriguez.
He's
like,
not Khamzat Chimaev.
I think Yair's more a slightly better example, just because Yair's somebody who, no matter what you do in your life, you can't move like he does unless you were just brought up like with the Taekwondo. His movement is so unique that I don't care what you did. Like, it's really hard to replicate that. Rob Font isn't, though. Like, he's an extremely technically sound boxer. He has good cardio. He's very durable. He's got good, like, takedown defense. Like, it's all very basic stuff, but when you add all those basic things together, it forms a very difficult fighter to beat. Whereas Jose Aldo, I guess his NBA comp would be Kevin Durant. Like, his striking is so good, similar to Durant's scoring, that you forget about all the other things that he can bring to the table. But like you said, we're starting to see more than just the Muay Thai Jose Aldo. And the thing I always remember, it's a Joe Roganism, if ever there was one, was this is a real jiu-jitsu black belt. We just never see it because his striking's so good. But to Rogan's credit, that is true. Like, Aldo is a world-class grappler, but his striking's just so good that we've never really had to see that wrinkle out of his game. And yes, the Piotr Jan fight notwithstanding, he's never been out-grappled in a fight before, and Aldo really does have some of the best takedown defense ever. Now, it's odd that Piotr Jan fights Jose Aldo and almost adopts that same takedown defense, because I would say Jan is neck and neck there with Aldo for takedown defense, but Aldo just has such great reactions with his hips. If you feign a takedown, he can sprawl on it. He's good at damaging his opponents when they go for takedowns. Like, his whole game is built around, I defend your takedown, I beat up your legs, and I beat your head. Like, he just has a game that everything fits together. I've said that for a few guys. Like, they have a great game. Lewis Smolka is a good fighter. It's just not everything he does really synergizes and matches together all that well. With Aldo, it's the opposite. His leg kicks set up the hooks, which then set up the body shots, which then can open up the rest of his game. It's just everything Aldo's done and all the experiences that he has gained throughout his MMA career have just led him to this point where he isn't just the MMA fighter. He's not just the wrestler, the jiu-jitsu guy. He can pull it all together when he has to, and that might make him the most dangerous version he's ever been.
Well, and the craziest thing about it, and this is where I'm going to try and bring some numbers in so we can talk about it. For Jose Aldo, since 2019... he's fought twice as much as Rob Font. Rob Font's only had three fights, and they were against Ricky Simone, Marlon Moraes, and again, the aforementioned Cody Garbrandt. But for Jose Aldo, I mean, the list goes on. He fought Moicano, he fought Volkanovski, Jan, Vera, Moraes, and then as well, his last time out, he had a giant win against Pedro Munhoz. The thing that scares me, and this is where I want to go with the numbers, and the reason why I say the sample size from the last 2 years isn't fair, but I can even creep back for Rob Font, too. I can go back, bring in the Pettis fight. Rob Font against Sergio Pettis in the first round, for significant strikes, went 48 of 111. That's an insane number.
They were all jabs, though.
48 of 111 significant strikes. Against Ricky Simone, 18 of 42. Against Moraes, 30 of 37. Against Garbrandt, 21 of 44. a very high pace. The average of just the three fights in the last, 2 years is 23 strikes per round. That's the average. So 23 in the first round. For Jose Aldo, 10 of 27 against Moicano, 8 of 23 against Volkanovski, against Moraes, 15 of 40, against Jan, 14 of 39, against Vera, 19 of 29, against Munoz, 25 out of 60, an average of 15.16 repeating. Jose Aldo is not a giant first-round fighter. He brings it on as the fight goes on. Rob Font starts strong, but he keeps that pace. Now, he was able to do that against Garbrandt to great effect his last time out, hoping to do that against Aldo here. My big thing for this fight, Matt, and the reason I bring up the first round, I think pace is the most important thing about this one, and it's whoever's going to be able to figure it out in the first round, figure out the distance, and start to implement their game first.
I don't think you're wrong, but I do disagree a little bit. Rob Font's really good at fighting guys shorter than him, like a lot of counter-strikers are. And I go back to the Conor McGregor effect. How did Conor beat Aldo? He feints, he makes Aldo jump into the pocket, he catches him on the way in. I think Rob Font's only way to win this fight is catching Jose Aldo on the way in. I don't think he can stand at range with Aldo, because this is the problem everyone forgets. Where Font can have his most success is where he's going to take the most damage. Where I can jab you is where you can leg kick me. And the last time Jose Aldo fought a great boxer, his name was Piotr Jan. And he kicked his front leg so much he forced Jan to become a southpaw fighter. Jan is primarily an orthodox fighter, though.
Pretty damn good in southpaw.
I get it. My whole point, though, is that if Jose Aldo is good enough to start negating some of the weapons of Piotr Jan on the feet, he can do the exact same thing to Rob Font. It's my whole, you might be good, but there's another guy out there who's great at this. And with Piotr Jan, he might be the best boxer in the UFC. He probably is. Dustin Poirier said that a week ago, and he's probably on that short list of who else is the best boxer in the UFC. So the fact that Aldo had good success against Jan, at least early on in that fight, does give me a lot of confidence against Rob Font. Because the difference with Font and Jan is that, yes, they're both boxers, but Rob Font needs a lot of range for him to get a lot of his strikes off. With Garbrandt, it's a lot of that jab-jab right hand, I skip back out to my range and I force you to close the distance again. When he fights guys who are his size, he doesn't have the advantage of, okay, I can just wait on my opponent, wait for them to jump into range. I think Aldo is going to really eat up that front leg when they do stand at range. And I think when Aldo does get on the inside, he's going to hit him with big power, similar to John Lineker. John Lineker got in the inside of Rob Font's punching range and destroyed him. Beat the body up, went to the head, and really made it an ugly fight. We've seen Jose Aldo do that against some of the best fighters in the world, and I expect him to do the same.
That's the fight that I go back to, is the Lineker fight. And if you want to see a good interview with John Lineker, hey, friend of the show, Drake Riggs, he just had a great one with him. And he has some PED things to say about TJ Dillashaw on that one. It's in the thumbnail as well. But yeah, when I look at this one, it all depends. Is Jose Aldo going to go to the legs? Is he going to throw the leg kick? Is he going to stay consistent with it? Because in certain fights, he does.
He did to Pedro.
He used to do it all the time. He did it to Pedro. He did it a little bit to Marlon Vera. There are bits and pieces where you can see it coming back together. So we throw it on over to you out there. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, but the YouTube community tab is where it's at. I threw this one out a day ago. 1,600 total votes. I said, previews and predictions, signed, sealed, and delivered tomorrow, today. But first, who gets it done in the main event? 51% Jose Aldo. And that's a pretty good sample size. That's more than you get from Tapology. The comments section lit up. Rob G said, Aldo has a shot if he utilizes those savage leg kicks. AJ Philbrock saying, would love to see Font get it done for MA, Massachusetts, and beat Aldo, but Aldo's still a beast. If Jose remembers how good of a leg kicker he is, I would go with Aldo, but in a stand-up boxing match, I have to go with Rob Font.
And I don't even think Aldo's the worst boxer than Rob Font.
Training with the Brazilian, who is it? Not National Guard. It's the Brazilian Army is who he's training his boxing with.
Again, Aldo is so good at Muay Thai, you forget about how good he is at everything else. And Aldo really has become more of a boxer, especially at this stage in his career. And it's kind of like, this is my last basketball reference, I promise, Craig. It's like DeMar DeRozan when he went to the Spurs. He was a great scorer with the Raptors, but when he went to a bad team, it forced him to become more than just a scorer. Similar to Jose Aldo at this stage of his career. He doesn't have that one-punch knockout power anymore, so he has to go and find more to add to his game. I think this is probably the most well-rounded version of Jose Aldo we've ever seen, but this is my big caveat in this fight. The weight cut must be terrible for Aldo to get to 135. I know he looks good in the cage, but I always worry about him making this weight. And Rob Font is a dangerous puncher on the outside, and we've seen Aldo get finished before.
Another comment, Dipinder R, saying Aldo is 10 minutes to finish Font, otherwise he's getting walked down and beat up by straight punches. Dipinder got a lot of likes on that one. Drew Kelleher saying it's 50-50 in a 3-rounder, but I'll go Font in a 5-rounder, and we'll go with one more. Matt, we have Rob Font going to piece Aldo up the first 2 rounds. I think it's close. Font and Aldo can't handle the 5-round stamina. So Matt, a lot of the commentary on with Rob Font, a few going with Jose Aldo. Let's talk about the odds really quick for this one, because Font opened a minus 115. He's a minus 152 favorite. Jose Aldo opened a minus 105. He's a plus 124 average on best fight odds. The Tapology votes, we haven't looked at them. Again, ours are 51% Aldo, 49% Rob Font. Topology's got 54% Aldo, 46% Font. At 1,300 votes, you guys are doing better than the Topology voters. Here at Fight Night Picks, you're the best fans out there. Now, Matt, that's not me just playing to the audience. That is the truth. We look at this fight, though. We talked a little bit about more about Jose Aldo at 35 rounding on his game. But again, Rob Font, man, like, this guy has had losses to Lineker. He's had losses to a Sunsell. And all of a sudden at 34, he's making his case for a title shot. Like, this is insane.
It really is. And
it's like, well, a Jan Blachowicz run.
Let's calm down a little bit. He's going to be around the top 10 for a really long time. I just don't look at Rob Font as a top 4, top 3 guy who can get a title shot. I think he can be a tough fight. He's the Dan Hooker of this division, kind of, where no matter who you're in there with, you can have a fight of the night with him. I just think he's going to struggle against the top, top tier of the division. Like, Cody Garbrandt doesn't even fight at bantamweight anymore. He's talking about moving down to flyweight. Jose Aldo fought at featherweight and is arguably the greatest featherweight of all time. Like, this is the last thing I'm going to say, too. What would you give Rafael Asensio out of 10 on a punching power scale? Like a 2, maybe? It's not very high.
4.
He dropped Rob Font pretty bad in their fight. He didn't finish him, but he hurt him pretty bad. If Rafael Asensio can drop you in an MMA fight, Jose Aldo could put you to sleep. I think Aldo's going to win.
I've got Brazil's Jose Aldo in this fight. Again, I think he brings that complete package. If he throws a shred of a leg kick to even force Rob Font to change his game plan, that's key. As long as you can make him respect the kick to start to rip to the body, to then to go to the head, I like Aldo. But again, Rob Font has great body shots of his own, and he's the type of guy, and we love this at Fight Night Picks, he's got pop at the end of his shot, and he uses length very well. You talked about it being the taller fighter, the longer fighter, having success in this division. He has those metrics in this fight too, and he can definitely make it work. So let us know down below in the comments section. Keep this conversation going and let us know who you have. Get into those fiery debates. Maybe you'll see one of us hop in there with you as well. For right now, both of us going with Brazil's Jose Aldo.
Few things get me more fired up as an MMA fan than hearing "Feel it coming in the air." Just Rihanna breaking it down for Run This Town, then Jose Aldo coming out. The best walkout song in MMA history. Yeah, I think Jose Aldo's got it, Tom.
Best walkout song in MMA history is Wild Boys for Mirko Krokop. That's neither here nor there. We got a great weekend of MMA coming up. 14 fights on this card as we tape this on Sunday. If there's any changes, we will update them here. The new individual videos, they have an individual look. It's a different look, something to keep your eye out for. We also have some great shows here as well with Early Stoppage dropping weekly. And if you're missing it, why? I had a goatee in the latest episode. Wow. Go check it out. I talk about Reed Johnson and Kyle Schwarber and the great baseball facial hair guys of all time. If you're missing it, you shouldn't. Check it out. All sorts of great stuff with Fight Night Picks, as well as the website where our own Joshua Hart loves to drop some stuff as well. Matt, there should be a great weekend in MMA.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal card this weekend. So have a great week, everybody, and get ready for this insane main event.
All right. Well, as we always say with Fight Night Picks,
let's get into it.